720 WGN and a happy Sunday morning, everyone. John Hanson and Esmeralda Leon.
Radical.
Whoa. That was kind of how that bump in was.
That was the most 80s music, movie, montage-y music I've ever heard.
Curtis Koch, who was that?
I don't know who it was. That's Dave's normal bring-in music.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, it sounds very much like we should have done a montage in a closet where you're changing, and I'm like, no, yes, yeah, see, we rocked it.
I was thinking like driving through convertibles through Miami, sort of. That's what it sounded like to me.
With two blondes.
Yes.
In those 80s bikinis with the high cut.
Yeah, by the way, can we talk about that just for a second?
And they're standing in the car.
What was up with the bikinis? And maybe you can help out with this, Esmeralda.
The bikinis.
The ones where the bottoms, like, came up and, you know, like, it's
like high cut.
High cut.
Yeah, they essentially, like, go up to your waist.
Why do...
But it's all open there.
I'm the wrong man. I'm the wrong man to ask about this in any generation or any decade.
I don't get it either.
But what was up with that? If someone could let me know, 312-981-7200.
What's the deal with 80s bikinis?
I want someone that was someone of the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the 60s. Which look do you prefer on a woman? Is it the bikini of the 60s, which is a little bit more coverage, a one piece perhaps?
No, that's not even, because they had bikinis.
Well, then what about the...
But they were just cuter.
I want to know what was attractive about that 80s high-cut bathing suit. And maybe Roger Badish is the wrong person to ask this
to. It is.
Happily
married. Yeah, he is. Yeah.
I just don't get that. I look back at movies and commercials and things. I was watching Casino the other night, and they were showing... And that's more 70s, but it was showing that style. I mean, what was attractive about that?
I don't think there was... I don't know. I don't know.
I think it's just more
skin. I'm not a woman.
I want to know someone who...
Roger, I know you're not a woman. I'm not saying, what did you feel comfortable wearing, Roger? I'm saying when you looked at people...
If you were a woman, Roger, what bikini would you wear?
By the way, I need to lose
40 pounds before I answer that.
We've hit that moment in the show very early when we fill in for Dave, by the way, where we say, I don't think Dave Plyer would cover this, but
we should get some sort of drop in where it goes, this is what Dave wouldn't talk about.
This is what Dave's always been thinking about talking on the show, but Dave.
This is like the first time John and Esmeralda and I were, like, when we first worked together, back like around Christmas time, and we spent the first like 10 minutes of the show talking about our pudgy fingers.
Yes.
Dave Plyer wouldn't talk about.
No, and then people were they loved it. They're like, I too have pudgy fingers. There's now support groups all over the country because of us.
Well, you know, we're just
pudgy
doing the work. So I don't know. I don't really get the high cut 80s thing.
Okay, so 859 says high cut bikini was supposed to make your legs look longer, which I agree, but it looks I don't know, because you have that. So you usually have that cut in where your hip to your leg to your thigh bends. So,
well, hold on. The bikini is connected to the
hip and your leg.
Okay.
And when you sit down and you have a lap, there's that line you get because when you sit,
I see this.
It's a line.
The sitting line, yeah.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I sit a lot, so I got a line. But yeah, you could see that in those bikinis. I never understood it. Mm-hmm. It looks weird.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't really get it. And
by the way, 262 says 1940s bikinis were horrid. I don't think they wore bikinis.
I think
the bikini wasn't invented until the 50s.
That was a bathing suit, like a literal bathing suit that was much knees.
So I just Googled
elbows.
1940s bikini, and they're a little bit more frilly. They've got a lot of skirts, and they've got like the high waisted. They're still a two piece.
Oh, really?
There's a two piece, and it has the top. The top looks relatively similar, but what's happening on the bottom is it looks more like a diaper. So that
cool.
I think that's what that text
diaper
is saying.
Look. Mm-hmm.
So 312-981-7200. What's your favorite bikini to wear or style of bikini? Really appropriate for her.
I feel terrible now because the 870 says Joe Satriani is the intro music.
Oh,
and I was making fun of it.
That's
sorry.
Okay. No, it's
Joe
okay.
Satriani is
Did they get mad at you for making fun of it?
No, but I kind of feel like they're schooling me. So.
1946? Wow, I thought it was later than that.
The bikini?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was later,
And how
too.
Did it get its name? I'm just finding out.
I don't know, Roger. How did a bikini
get
its
bikini
name?
The Bikini Atoll, which is a... like the top of a volcano.
Yeah.
A volcano. I can't even talk this morning. A volcano, but it's in the ocean. So you just see the ring.
Oh.
And that's what and it's the Bikini Islands. And there's part of that where it looks like that.
Oh, it looks like a bikini?
Not at all.
Okay. So it was just some islands where they're like, I like that name. I'm going to name this
And the guy was from Paris.
I see. What? I can see the shape of it, though.
It does have a shape of a bikini.
It's sort of a shape of a specific part of a bikini.
Okay. Well, at least.
The top part, specifically.
Okay. No, but Roger was making it sound like he was just like, I like that name. I'm going to take that. No.
Yeah, but he says he named it after the Bikini Atoll where testing on a nuclear bomb was taking place. So there you go.
Great.
Yeah.
Very fascinating start to the show today. Esmeralda, how are you doing? How's life? We haven't been together in a little bit.
I'm good.
Yeah?
I'm good. Just sitting around.
You've been cramming for tonight.
I did. I watched a bunch of movies. I don't usually do that. Mm-hmm. But I was... this is going to sound horrible, mm-hmm. but I was just laying about all day.
That's
doing,
fine.
In bed.
That's what you're supposed to do on a Saturday. That's what you're supposed to do. There's nothing wrong with that.
Right, but I never do that. But for some reason, laying down made it better.
Oh, so you never even sat up. You were just in the bed.
I sat up.
How did you get all these movies, by the way? Did you pirate these movies?
No.
Oh, that didn't sound very...
You can get them on Amazon.
Okay.
You can buy them on Amazon.
Okay. Esmeralda.
And Redboxes.
I was curious about that, how you were watching all these movies that are in the theaters at home.
They're not in the theaters.
Okay.
They are now because they're specials.
Re-release,
and actually, I actually think they're still going on. Mm-hmm. AMC is doing marathons.
Oh, okay.
But I wasn't prepared to sit in albeit comfy seats that they
you
have.
You wanted to be completely
I wanted to be
reclined.
Completely vertical.
Right.
Under covers, which they don't give you at the AMC.
Yeah, that should be what they do at the theaters, is just beds.
Oh my gosh.
You know what it should be? It should be like those really fancy planes when you go to the movie theater. There's the coach, which the normal people can sit in.
Yeah.
The rest of us who like to be sitting up when we watch movies. You have, occasional drink service, but mm-hmm. really you got to buy everything on your own. Mm-hmm. Then there should be first class movie theaters, which now they should have pods where you can just lay and watch the movies.
That would actually be amazing, like in those airplanes.
Yeah, you've got a great idea.
Fancy airplanes.
That's what I was saying. It'd be a first class with the lay down and the rest of the people can lay on down. So you've been cramming.
Let's
build
put some money into mm-hmm. that.
I need to stop Google searching bikinis here.
You're going to get in trouble with HR.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's good. So we're going to.
But yeah, I've been cramming because mm-hmm. we have Blake Stubbs in.
Yeah, we got Blake Stubbs.
We're going to talk to him.
He's going to come on around 2:30 or 3. We haven't decided yet. We'll tell him when we're going to get him on, but we're going to chat through movies, the best pictures, and
it's tonight.
It is tonight.
It's tonight. Oscars,
which is great. Curtis, are you a big Oscars fan? Do you care?
A little bit. I haven't seen a lot of movies yet either this year. The most recent one I saw was Black Panther,
okay,
which was really good. I liked that one a lot.
Mm-hmm. But that would be for 2018.
Yeah, no, exactly. That'd be for next year.
Have you seen anything nominated?
I saw Dunkirk.
Okay.
Earlier this year, Roger was talking to Dave and mm-hmm. Lisa about that. That's really only it. I don't see movies much, and also because I was still in school at the time, so I didn't have much time to go see as much movies as I would like to.
No, I'm the same way. I can't sit around for 2 hours.
I used to love the Oscars. I used to watch all the movies, and I just have fallen. That's fallen out of favor a little bit for me, but because I can remember as a kid even watching them and just loving the pomp and the circumstances.
Yeah.
I have a very specific memory of when I was. I think I was a teenager at the time, and Shakespeare in Love won Best Picture. I believe this was 1997, 1998. It was a big upset over Saving Private Ryan.
I'm going to say 96.
Okay. It was one of those years, and I remember watching it. It was late at night, and I remember being like, oh my God, Shakespeare in Love won the Best Picture, and going in and waking up my parents and telling them, and they're like, dude, we don't, what are
oh,
you,
I'm
why
sorry,
are
99.
You? Okay, 99. So yeah, it came out in 98. I think it beat Saving Private Ryan or some other films that were nominated. And I was just so surprised, and I was like, oh, this is the biggest deal, the biggest news. And I actually, I went in, and my dad's like, I got to wake up in like 6 hours. What are you doing waking me up to tell me who won Best Picture?
Yeah.
But as a kid, it was presented as such a big night. I thought this was news that everyone needed to hear.
I was the same way. I would stay up.
Yeah.
I remember clearly, again, in bed. Because it would go so long. And I was like, I have to go to bed because I have school in the morning. But then I would be like, well, I'm just going to keep watching. I'm going to keep waiting. And then it would just keep going.
Did you have a cat in bed with you then, too?
No, unfortunately, no cat.
Man, Esmeralda, you
now
love
I'm living
laying
my best
in bed.
Life.
Now
I have a cat, finally.
312-91-7200. Some people, I feel like relaxing and laying around on a Saturday or a Sunday is perfectly okay. But, so, you know, I feel like we always have to preface it by saying, this is kind of gross, but I was just laying in bed all day. No,
well,
be proud of it.
Because I left, so my house is in ruins right now. Just it's
Pardon?
Just gross.
Oh, it's just okay.
There's dishes everywhere. Yeah. There's dust.
No, nah, that's for next
and
Saturday.
And I'm a layabout.
Are you
going to
do it today?
Bed.
Or are you going to lay about the bed?
I don't know.
312-91-7200. What's your favorite thing to do in your bed, layabout or other things? Let
okay.
us know. All right. Well,
you opened quite a Pandora's box there. Yeah, what do you like to do in bed?
I'm fine with that. you can open that box in bed too. We're going to take a quick commercial break and then plenty more on 720 WGN.
Around her she walked. She was afraid to come out in the open, and so she sat bundled up on the shore.
2, 3, 4, tell the people what she wore.
It was an itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini that she wore.
720 WGN. We're talking about bikinis naturally here on March 3rd or whatever day this is. Of course, that was itsy bitsy.
4th.
Is it the 4th?
Wow. Whatever day.
So that,
April 29th.
So that movie came out in 19... Or that movie. That song came out in 1959. So, yeah. I mean, bikinis clearly had been around for about 10 years.
That was a movie?
No. I said movie. I meant song.
Oh, okay.
I got
you got the movies on the brain.
By the way, I was thinking about the sleep apnea live read I did. And they'll come to you and all that, and you can just lay around in bed. So even if you don't have it, that'd be a good excuse for
even
you.
Even to get sleep apnea?
No, what I'm saying to get it, I'm saying is that if anyone ever judged you, like, what are you doing laying around all day?
Be
like,
I'm
doing a sleep apnea test.
I
contacted sleepstudyspecialists.com.
I'm going to keep that one in my pocket.
It's a 3-month study. I've got to lay here all day, every day.
Have you ever seen those? They have competitions, like, who can lay about the most? And
wait,
it's people
really?
Just laying in bed for days on end.
See, I love a good nap. I like sleeping in when I can.
Right.
But, man, I just get that anxiety that I should be doing something else.
Yeah.
After about 20 minutes after I wake up, and normally when I wake up in the mornings, and I work on the morning show, like, I gotta go. Like, there's no, I don't hit the snooze ever anymore. I used to be a snoozer hitter. Never. As soon as that first alarm is up, I gotta go. And that's because I want as much time as I can in the morning to sleep. But like, let's say on a Saturday or a Friday, I can lay there for maybe 10 or 15 minutes and I'm like, I gotta get up and do something. And it's just guilt. I don't have anything to do. It's like I get up and go to the couch and I make coffee and then I just move my butt to the couch instead of the bed and do something else.
I do the same thing, but then I just roll over and go back to sleep.
For how long? Like,
I'll go, I should wake up. And then I just kind of pass back out.
So
and then wake up 3 hours later and go,
Let's really ascertain, because I want to know how long we're talking about here yesterday for your Saturday. How many hours did you, and were you laying down, like fully laying down the whole time? Like,
okay, I was propped up on my elbow at some point.
How many hours are we talking?
At one point, I propped up on my pillows.
Okay.
So I wasn't completely vertical at all times.
To prevent bed sores.
Okay, so this is what happened.
Or muscle atrophy.
Yeah,
Esmeralda propped herself up on her elbow.
Okay, we'll get this. So I watched Mudbound. I watched that late night because I had, because my sleep schedule is I sleep in the day.
Yeah.
So I watched that and then
this
I
is
went,
so what Friday night you watched this?
Friday night. About
I'm gonna
two...
count down these hours. I'm doing a log of.
But,
I'm doing
oh,
a sleep
one,
apnea study
this
for Esmeralda.
This one was on my couch.
Okay.
This one was on my couch.
So you started on the couch.
This one doesn't count, I guess.
All right.
And then I went to bed. I took a quick nap. 6 a.m. I woke up.
Saturday morning. Okay.
And then I went to my 7 a.m. workout class.
Okay.
What?
So you're already fine then.
And I worked out.
Right. Is that all?
Like
you...
proper working out.
Mm-hmm.
Where the man had to tell me that things were bad. I can't put my arms back
form?
All the way.
You had a... Was it just a random stranger at the gym?
No, it was a class. It was a class, but I was
okay.
the only one in it.
Oh.
It was weird. Because
well,
he's like, usually there's all these women. I'm like, oh, where are they today?
Yep.
It was fine.
He was your personal guy. Okay.
But it
so
was
you-
like all these things. Like I couldn't do squats because then my back started to hurt. And he's like, you need to roll, foam roll.
Well,
and it was just then me asking questions.
Or
for
you need to not lay
hour.
In bed for the whole weekend.
No, now I should foam roll.
You got to foam roll.
As I lay down.
Okay.
No, and then, so I got home.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was 8:30.
Okay.
I went to bed and watched Phantom Thread.
Okay.
So it's probably hour and change.
Okay.
Something like that. And then I fell asleep.
Okay. Okay.
Well, I had to go to sleep.
Oh, true. You had to go to real sleep. Right.
And then I watched The Shape of Water.
Okay.
And I don't know. It was maybe a couple hours.
Okay.
Maybe 5 hours about, and I was asleep.
Okay.
And then watched Shape of Water.
Okay.
And then I started to watch Three Billboards.
Okay.
And then I got up, went to dinner, and then I came back and watched it.
And went back to bed and watched
and
it.
And I did go back to bed.
I think I'm up to about 15 out of 17 hours you were laying in bed.
I was laying around for a good, like before I came here, I was still laying around in bed.
Right. She's also laying it down right now, people, if you can't tell.
Yeah,
she's
I'm in a Tempur-Pedic.
She rolled
it
in.
Lifts me.
Yeah, she just puts in a different sleep number to do the radio show.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. That would be so nice.
You know, I'm not going to judge. That's what you should be doing. This
rumor has it they're putting in sleep number beds at the new studio.
Yes. Oh yes, just for Esmeralda.
It's
just
because, for Esmeralda. Yeah, because I suggested it and they loved it.
312-91-7200 is Esmeralda too lazy on the weekends?
I'm too lazy for my own good.
You know, I feel like weekends should be for whatever the heck you want it to be.
Right. But then again, like I said, my house is disgusting right now.
Right.
And I would get up. To use the bathroom or grab chips. And
what, you'd eat the
after
chips
I worked
in bed?
Out? Yes. There was no, I got the crumbs out.
Hey, you know what? In Esmeralda's defense, I have eaten the rest of my girlfriend got me candy for Valentine's Day. I've eaten some of the candy that I've got while watching Hulu.
Yeah.
In bed.
Yes.
Oh, I eat whole
propped
meals
up
in
or
bed.
Laying down flat?
I'd lay down on my side. So I lay on my side. I have my hand, I had my pillow, like, make my pillow go in half because it's like a memory foam pillow, so it'll just stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And then just rest my head on the side and just put a Hershey Kiss or chocolate heart in my mouth while I'm watching, like, Family Guy or something like that. That's how I spend my nights.
I eat whole meals in bed.
What it's are you fine. Talking about?
I need to invest in one of those little tray table things.
You just need a... Yes.
Like, taking breakfast in bed to a whole new level.
Come on.
Every meal in bed. Wait. You eat entire meals like with silverware and everything.
So like usually they're hands.
She actually got a harness for her cat to go to the kitchen, and it'll come back with whatever she wants.
Man, I wish my cat would do that. Are you kidding me? I tried to get my dog when I had a dog growing up. We tried to get him to take beers to my dad.
Right.
And we tried to attach one to his collar, but it wasn't working. Mm-hmm. I think he shaked it off. We're like, no,
no beer collar.
Take it.
Okay, so. In Esmeralda's fantasy land, a weekend would be filled with a cat butler bringing you in.
How adorable with the little... Oh, come on.
Bringing you a little bow tie.
A little bow tie.
So wait, hold on. Look, when you talk about whole meals in bed, what are you talking
I'm
about?
It's not like I'm having three courses.
Bacon and eggs.
That's what I'm wondering. Like,
We're really terrible. We do have a kitchen table, but we eat like on the couch.
That's fine. I never eat at the kitchen
table.
And
we have a coffee table that's pretty much like our table.
That's how I use it too. That's fine.
So then what's the difference between that and a bed?
The bed is where you sleep.
It's not like I'm eating it on the sheets. I have a plate.
Oh, that'd be incredible. And you just roll up the sheet and you throw it in the laundry basket and be like, well, get that barbecue sauce on. Yep.
It's like a picnic on my bed.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You should have a picnic, a bed basket with different silverware and plates like that.
I've done that before. Not in bed. I've done it in my living room. I had a picnic.
Well, that's sweet. I mean, you're at least in the upright position. I'm just so curious about, like, if you're eating an entire meal in bed. 312-91-7200. Is Esmeralda unique in when she does this? I don't know.
No, come on. You call in, you text, and you eat in bed.
A little candy, a little couple chips, maybe, but I feel gross doing it. And immediately...
You just have to make sure to get the crumbs out.
And how do you do that? You just shake them
off?
You
just push
onto the floor?
I mean, you got to sweep it anyway.
Your life. You kind of are a little bit of a slob.
I mean, why do you sweep up the floor? Because there's dirt and stuff on it. So what's the difference? You know, if you're gonna sweep up,
you don't sweep it up because there's leftovers on the floor. I mean,
but you're gonna have there's crumbs.
Yeah.
So what's the difference between that and the dust bunnies?
I don't know, Roger. Do you eat in bed?
No,
never.
Well, all right. Hold on a second.
Okay.
Come on, Roger. Live a little.
Because there's. I did not eat when I slept in the regular bed, but ever since my operation, I have not been able to sleep in a regular bed.
Okay.
So I sleep in a recliner, which is the same recliner that I sit in most of the day when I'm not out running around.
Right.
So do I have stuff to eat while I'm sitting in the recliner? Yes.
Yeah, the recliner, that's not as bad. I know that is your bed right now, so that's a little different, but at least you're upright.
Yeah, I was going to say that's better. That has more support.
Yeah.
It's great.
It is very comfortable.
Although I do have a mattress pad on my bed.
Wait, okay.
More support.
Yes.
I have a mattress topper.
I got a mattress pad, too, as well. 312-91-7200, do you eat in bed? I'm really curious because I know that most people probably will have a snack, but I mean the full meal where you're actually something's been cooked. Something's been cooked somewhere else in the kitchen, prepared a dish.
Unless you're sick and you're being taken care of
by her cat butler, which is what she wants ideally.
I love a cat butler.
Cat butler.
Multiple. A cat butler and dog butler.
All right, we got to take a quick commercial break. Let us know if you eat in bed. 312-91-7200 news after this, but quick break on WGN. WGN. Hey, this is a message to any of Esmeralda Leon's future children, if she has them. So
future cats.
Future cats. So. If it's Mother's Day and Esmeralda Leon's your mom, you sometimes for Mother's Day you bring breakfast in bed. But if you are anyone trying to please Esmeralda Leon, you will bring a full steak.
All three meals in bed.
I'm
not leaving.
And so we were talking about this, and I admitted to you that I have eaten a sandwich in bed. Okay, so I can think of like a late night, especially if I was a little tipsy. And I don't have to go too far to do this. Just last night, Friday night, I was down visiting my friends, including Blake, who we're going to talk to in a moment, down in Champaign. I had a little leftover pizza at the hotel room. I had the pizza in bed. Now, I only did that. I would never have pizza in bed at home. And that's not entirely true. So I had pizza in bed.
Hypocrite.
It also wasn't my bed. It was the hotel bed, which I felt was different. And it was handheld.
Well, that's what I was just going to get at. Is it different when you have like room service? And, like, for example...
Yeah.
No, room service I would eat at the table. If it was, like, if it's...
But if there is no table.
If there is no table and you're getting up early, like, for example, my buddy and I, when we went to Cubs convention, we ordered room service for 6 o'clock in the morning and we got it. And we literally ate our breakfast in bed before we got up to really start the day.
Let me preface this by saying, I think hotel rules are out. It's not your bed. Whatever you do in your hotel bed.
So if you're in
whatever you want to do in
there.
You're
in other people's beds. Go to town.
Yes. Right. If you met someone for the night and you want to eat in their bed
you
in the morning,
you get those eggs and bacon.
You get them. Hey, hon. Anyways, I don't know why you'd call anyone hon the first morning. Anyways, side note.
It's a whole other topic.
Well, here's what I'm getting at, is that you would eat or have eaten things in bed that involve silverware.
Yeah, I love that you think it's so weird, like I'm just eating from far away, trying to balance food on a fork to my mouth. No, I bring the plate up to my mouth and I eat. You're just like, what about rice?
Yeah, what about rice? You do not want rice. You do not want to go back into bed. First of all, crumbs are the worst, and the chips, and you say you wash it off. But rice can be sticky if it's some sort of sticky rice situation.
Yeah, well,
you don't want to be laying in bed 3 nights later. You got sticky rice all up in your business.
Plate to mouth. And I don't know about you, but I make it most of the time.
What about soup?
Yeah, that's perfect.
I love soup in a mug.
See, with one of those scoops in it.
Yeah.
Soup.
Like the kids, like the little babies with the catch-all down there.
Like little babies.
And you have snacks?
Yeah.
They don't make them for anyone over the age of 4 months old. And there's
what store are you shopping at?
Yeah.
Amazon's got everything.
We'll just make one.
You'd eat soup in bed?
Yeah.
People the hoi polloi do.
Yeah, me.
I can't imagine.
I love drinking soup out of mugs.
Okay, fine.
I love drinking soup out of mugs. I have mugs, like big old soup mugs.
Wait, drinking? Like you drink it like it's your coffee?
Yeah. I've done that before.
I've never done that before. I have special soup mugs with handles and, I mean, you need a spoon still, but for the most part, you sip it and then you're cozy in bed under the blanket. So nice.
Like a little bisque. 847 texts in. My wife will eat full meals in bed, and it drives me crazy. Yeah.
He's probably mad because she doesn't share.
Hotel beds, exemption. When you're sick and you have the tray and you can't get out of bed, okay. Totally makes sense.
I mean, you can always get out of bed.
If you're bedridden.
Unless you're bedridden, that's a whole other situation.
Whatever. You can do whatever you need to do in bed. But I'm just talking about the general course of your day. Drunk eating. Let's all exempt that. But I'm saying, like, you made dinner to get, like, did you and, have you and the boo ever made dinner and brought it to the bed to eat?
No.
Okay, so that would be more of a sit-down, formal setting at the coffee table. Yes, the couch.
But if it's, you know, if it's not a meal we made, like, I made meatloaf and mashed potatoes, but if we're just reheating stuff, we'll most likely just...
And he's fine with that?
And we're already in bed? It's not a thing of
Do you have a microwave in your bedroom just
yes,
so you could do...
Yes, just a little mini fridge microwave combo. No, it's not a thing of where I'm like, hey, let's have dinner in bed. Like, right. We're already in bed, and then we go, I'm hungry.
Like, you don't also, like, bring the crock pot into your bedroom, put it on for 10 hours so that in the morning you can have, like, some breakfast, like, right next to the bed.
That's not an even surface. Come on. I can't. Safety first.
I was
John.
Thinking on the
Safety
nightstand,
first.
A crock pot nightstand, and your cat butler would get up 5 hours into the night and stir it around just to make sure it was good. Oh, this is absurd. 312-91-7200. What's the weirdest thing you've ever eaten in bed? Actually, let's
Wow. You just
Where's that slap sound effect?
With
Where's
the that hits.
Yeah. Yeah. Where is it there? Go ahead, press that
gracious.
Button there.
I didn't even mean to
It's early in the morning. You're sleep deprived.
Yeah. I don't know.
How about we talk about what's happening tonight?
Oh, yeah, fine.
The Oscars.
And guess who we got on the phone? It's Blake Stubbs, Blockbuster Blake. How you doing, bud?
Good morning, you guys. How are you? Are you ready for this?
I think I am.
Sunday?
I think I am. Blake, are you eating anything? Are you in bed right now? Admit it, or if you're laying down.
I am not in bed.
Okay.
And I ate earlier.
Will you watch the Oscars in bed and eat?
I will not, because I actually go to an Oscar party every year.
You could get into their bed.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, if they'll allow it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, sometimes I get a little too antsy on Oscar Sunday, so maybe they have to go put me in timeout.
Yes, exactly. Aww.
We'll see what happens.
Now, Blake, I don't mean to, and we're going to talk about movies in a second. Sorry, Esmeralda. I just have one question for Blake. So I know Blake very well. Blockbuster Blake, a big movie critic, and he's great. He's on Dane Neal. He's awesome, all that stuff. But I've known Blake for a long time, and I've seen him at his sloppiest moments. And Blake, you would be someone I believe would eat a full course meal in bed. Am I correct or no?
I mean, why not?
Team Esmeralda.
I mean, if it's like fried chicken, of course I will.
Oh yes.
Oh my God! What fried chicken? That's so greasy.
Yes. High five.
Are you wiping your hands on the sheets?
No, you have napkins or a paper toweling or something. I mean,
what kind of monsters do you think we are?
Why? Yeah. If you are at the level that you're bringing napkins and cutlery into the bedroom, just eat it at a table.
Cloth napkins, right, Blake?
Yes. And they do build, you know, make like TV trays or lap trays that you can use. And
you're sick or bedridden.
I didn't know that there was rules to these trays.
Well, I mean, that's the only way I could rationalize being okay with it. I mean, I don't want to make a huge mess or, you know, like, I'm not one who would eat chips in bed or popcorn or any of that stuff. But, I mean, I'm not saying I'm above it. I'm just saying I haven't done it.
So you only do fine dining in bed. See, I'll do the popcorn and the chips. That doesn't bother me. But
he does seven-course meals.
He does the whole thing.
He gets a Linnea to come to his house.
All right, Blake.
But I'm allergic to cats, so it would have to be a dog butler. I'm just throwing that out.
Still,
there.
Same. It's good. Otter butler. Yeah. Any animal.
Who would be better at a butler? I feel like dogs are more trainable.
No, dogs.
Yeah. Okay.
No, a cat would not.
Yeah. No.
He'd be in the corner smoking. Like, I'm not going to help you.
Or it would knock off whatever you're eating, like onto the floor or onto the sheets.
Right. Yep. Just to spite you.
Oh my gosh, where have we gone? It's 2:42 on this Sunday morning. So
Oscars, Blake.
So Blake, are you? I mean, this is like your big night. This is like your Super Bowl.
This is. I mean, for many years, I've always found some place to talk about the Oscars in terms of, you know, broadcast. And this year in particular, like, I make sure, since 2009, you know, they started doing more than 5 nominees for Best Picture. So I always make sure I see them all. And I have. I've seen every Best Picture nominee since 2009. And I always want to make sure I give, you know, a fair either review, because, you know, sometimes these films can be reviewed like immediately because they have a big you know, presence, such as like when Lady Bird was, you know, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes for the longest time, or something like Dunkirk, which was this big, you know, World War II epic, or The Shape of Water, which everybody was talking about, but it had this slow sort of release, and, you know, it garnered a whole lot of buzz for the Oscars, even like before it was widely released across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to make sure I see all of these, you know, within a fair amount of time. And I've had a couple of years where, like, because of the films themselves, when they were released and what access I have to them, I've actually been watching them the night before the Oscars.
Okay.
Me too.
That's what Esmeralda does, yeah. But with a giant steak in her bed. That's how she watches it.
So, Blake, do you do predictions?
I try to predict, yeah. There's a few categories that I always definitely weigh in on or have a pretty solid prediction.
And how have you done?
With cinematography, I'm very accurate. In fact, a few years back, I thought it was going to be one, but I figured the Oscars would go with the other. You know what I mean? Like, I try
Oh, so you play
sure
the game. It's not only, you're predicting what the results will be, not necessarily what you think they should be.
Correct.
Hey, when you look at the whole,
if I picked the Oscars, it'd be something different sometimes.
Right.
So yeah,
Blake's Oscars.
When I yes, the blocks, the blocks, the blocksers.
I was gonna go Boskers.
Yeah. That's way better. Thank you. That's also what the Cat Butler would be named. Boskers.
Oh!
Boskers. The Cat Butler. Oh. Blake, I gotta ask you, when you've seen all the nominees, when you kind of, and we do this in sports too, where we analyze a draft class. How good is the overall class, top to bottom? When you put up these movies this year versus the last 7 or 8 years when we've had a big enough number of nominees. What do you think about this year's class of movies overall?
I think that it offers a very diverse, you know, sort of palette in terms of, you know, different types of taste of what types of films people might enjoy. For one,
in bed, sorry,
in bed. And two, I also think that, you know, you have a wealth of different types of directors. Some of these directors are first-time directors. Some of these directors are veterans. That have, you know, helmed these films. And at the same time, like, yeah, there's two films that take place during World War II, but they're both vastly different approaches to different sort of, you know, incidents that occurred or time periods that occurred during the war.
Mm-hmm.
There's very intimate stories here. There's also comedy in this category. There's also, you know, historical, you know, depictions. And then, of course, there's straight up fantasy. I mean, this class, I would say, is a very strong class compared to the last few years. It also, you know, building on that remark, I would also argue that this is one of the hardest years to predict since 2009, when they went to up to 10 nominees in a category. Now, there's 9 in this category, but I would definitely say that, you know, for me, there's at least 3 that could walk away with this statue based on the steam that they picked up, other awards that they've won, a lot of the buzz surrounding them. And then, of course, you know, sometimes the Oscars are nuts, and they just, the Academy will surprise you, and they will, you know, throw something out there. Like last year, there was that big, you know, ordeal where La La Land was announced, and then actually, like, La La Land did not win Best Picture. Mm-hmm. Moonlight did.
Right.
I remember sitting at the Oscars party that I go to, and I was like, no, Moonlight's Best Picture. This is not. Mm-mm, nope. And then, of course, the whole thing unfolded, and Moonlight did win, and I was one of, like, 3 people at the party that had Moonlight as Best Picture. And I was like, sometimes I can predict what they're going to do, and sometimes I'm way off. So if you're listening now and you want to bet money on this, don't take my word for it.
Right.
But there are a few categories that I think are solid locks. And you can, once you've seen enough of the films, or you've read enough about how some of these other nominees have done for other awards, like, you know, the Directors Guild of America usually has a very high prediction rate. In fact, it's almost 90% or higher for what wins Best Director, and then also potentially will win Best Picture. But at the same time, you know, there have been people that have gone on to win, like, the SAG Award and a Golden Globe, and then they don't even win, or they might not have even been nominated by the Academy. So sometimes it's easy to predict. Sometimes it's not.
We're going to get to those predictions in just a little bit, Blake. You're going to stay on the line. And also, we wanted to chat about if anyone has any big Oscar snubs out there. A movie that they've seen in their past that they, when they find out that it didn't win much or didn't win the Best Picture, that they're like, what? How is that possible? There's tons of them over the years. Of course, it's all a matter for opinion. But 312-91-7200, your predictions for the Oscars, and Blake will react to that. And biggest Oscar snubs coming up on 720 WGN. Little Foo Fighters here on 720 WGN. John Hanson and the wonderful, the beautiful.
Wow.
You're great, Esmeralda.
Oh,
I love
you. Thank you. I know.
Everyone, our texters love you, too. The 847 just says, I keep imagining Esmeralda being like Kramer.
Oh, yeah.
Sitting in bed eating the Kenny Rogers Roasters chicken.
Oh, and I would totally do that.
Which is,
are you kidding me? Yes.
Just like bobbing his head in bed. And
sounds like the best idea ever.
Blake Stubbs eats fried chicken in bed. He also is a movie critic. Blake, we're talking about the Oscars tonight, and we were talking about favorite kind of parts of the ceremony, and I know it's a big night for you, and it should be. You're totally into it. It's faded for me. I don't really watch it. Part of it's that I work in the, on the morning show now, so I've got to go to bed so early.
Right.
But I don't care about celebrities very much, so I don't watch the red carpet nonsense. Not nonsense. Sorry. If you like it, that's great. Sorry.
I like to be all judgy about what they're wearing.
That's cool. It's just not my thing. And then the ceremony I don't really love. I think it takes too long. I like the monologue to see what they do at the open. And I like, my favorite part of the Oscars is the in memoriam part.
Wow.
Because I think it's kind of, it's always makes me like sad or cry. But then I'm like, oh yeah, that person died. Oh, that person.
You
a lot of people that died.
You always know who the popular people
are.
Oh,
when they clap. Yeah.
They clap. How rude is everyone? Stop clapping. Wait till the end.
Poor costume designer who no one remembers from 1958.
Or like maybe three people in the audience knew them, so it's like you just hear this like...
At least no one boos.
Could you? Oh, could you imagine?
I mean, you never know in this climate. Blake, what's your favorite part of the actual ceremony?
For me, honestly, it's always going to be best cinematography.
Okay.
Whenever that award is given out, because I think it's, for me, when I'm watching films throughout the year, you know, you don't know what's going to be nominated. You can get a sense of what's going to be nominated. You know, some things come right out of the festival circuit and they're just like so huge and they have all this steam and then they get a great release and they're backed. But then honestly, sometimes I'm sitting in the theater and I've had this happen a couple of times. Once, the first time I saw Brokeback Mountain, and the second time was when I saw Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World.
Oh, so good.
I was so stunned by some of the photography in both of those films that I was like, that's going to win best cinematography.
So what do you
and
look
then they
for?
Did. Now, well, it's...
When you say best cinematography, what are you looking for? Is it the shots, lighting? Like, what is it? What is it that sticks out
for
you?
Well, it encompasses all of that. It encompasses, you know, the mise-en-scene of the scene, the composition of the shot, the place.
I eat some mise-en-scene in bed. I will let you do that, yeah.
Well, but there's
great
also
dish.
The lighting situation. Okay. You know, a great director of photography is really, you know, having this ongoing either battle or dance with creating excellent light within a shot. For example, this year, there are, you know, a lot of great nominees. I mean, first of all, Mudbound was one of the best shot movies of the year. Rachel Morrison is the first woman nominated ever in this category. There's another, you know, Shape of Water. If you saw that, the imagery of that film was so vivid. And it was very, you know, transportive to sit there and watch and go back. It's kind of like you were going back in time, but it's also this fantastical Cold War, feels like the 1960s, you know, kind of era, late 50s, early 60s.
Is everyone comparing it? Because when I saw it, I thought Amelie.
Amelie, yeah. Well, it's very whimsical. Yeah,
yeah, I thought immediately of that kind
element
of
to it.
Those
yeah,
French movies.
Much more like grounded, and yet you know, there's horror elements to it. There is some light comedy occasionally, and an endearing romance. You know, I can't go without mentioning that. That was one of the big hooks of the film. You've also got Dunkirk with Hoyte van Hoytema is nominated. This was a true epic. This was shot like the works of David Lean. You know, think Bridge on the River Kwai, think Lawrence of Arabia. It was shot in a very old school style, and it needed to be to showcase, you know, the vast emptiness of this beach filled with 400,000 soldiers, but also the dynamic nature of the dogfights that were taking place and all of the civilian sailors,
you know,
who were coming to rescue the infantry.
Blake, do you still see, when you're watching these movies on a TV or on the big screen, does it make a difference? Do you see differences when you change format?
Occasionally, when it comes down to, you know, if you can go into, for example, Dunkirk, I was just, you know, mentioning that one. That was a massive scale shot partially on IMAX, should have been seen in IMAX, should have been heard in an IMAX theater to really grasp the immersive nature of the film and how, you know, chaotic yet at the same time deliberate all of the editing was. Mm-hmm. I think that it is better to see it on a big screen most of the time. Sometimes you just can't. Do you know what I mean? Like Mudbound was not released widely in theaters.
So, and it depends on where you live. We're lucky here in Chicago, but some people in the outlying areas or downstate may not have access to all those theaters.
Yeah, and Mudbound, I saw it on Netflix.
Correct.
Right.
Yes, exactly. And that's where it was released. So Mudbound, you know, I mean, it obviously did get some theatrical release because it has to be considered for the Academy. But at the same time, you know, doing an L.A. and a New York release and then going straight to Netflix, they, you know, the exhibiting cost to, like, put this movie out in theaters was very down low. It had a very, you know, positive critical reaction, rightfully so. And audiences have loved it. So the fact that it is in this, you know, category, and not only to have been shot by a woman as well, and finally a woman is nominated in this category, is a very good thing. You know, you got Darkest Hour, which is the Gary Oldman-led Winston Churchill film. It was a beautifully shot film. I also thought it was pretty well edited, but I understand that a vast majority of what I loved about it was the way it was shot, not so much the way it was cut together.
And that's got to be hard to separate, because I think that sometimes you can like a movie, but you're going, it wasn't all that great, but you're like, but it was really cool what that photographer was able to do with it. That was the most intriguing part. I imagine that a movie that is shot beautifully, but it's not the best movie, it's, you know, it has its faults. I mean, those movies get hurt by that.
They do. What I like, though, is that a movie that is beautifully shot and may, on the whole, not be that great, can still be recognized in a category like this. You know what I mean? Like, it may not have been one of the top, you know, 10 films of the year.
Right.
But if it's undeniable that it was one of the best shots, and it meets all forms of criteria.
Like, if a Pauly Shore movie was shot beautifully, could that still win Best Cinematography?
It could.
Yeah.
If the studio backs it, because they have to back it. They can't just say, hey, you know, it was released, you should nominate it. They have to, like, really campaign for these things.
I mean, the last nominee that we have.
Put into it.
The last nominee, Blade Runner. Is it nominated for anything else?
Yes, visual effects and a couple of other things. And Roger Deakins, the man who's nominated for it, for shooting Blade Runner, actually has 13 nominations. This is his 14th. He has never won. He is the Susan Lucci of Best Cinematography. However, a lot of people think he's going to win tomorrow. In no way will I be unhappy. This is the guy that shot No Country for Old Men. He shot Skyfall. He has always put together beautiful images, and he is a case study in what it means to light scenes, especially Blade Runner. If you saw it, and maybe even specifically saw it on a big screen, you know, the atmosphere in going back to this Blade Runner universe, because, you know, this is a sequel film. But going back there, he really, I think, amplified it, and made it look immersive. It made it look, you know, dark when it needed to and bright when it needed. It's what he does with the camera and lights is just so unique. And there's always been some reason or another why he's lost. But for this year, I think it's his to run away with. However, I would give a close second to Dunkirk on this one. So I think the Academy is going to give it to Roger Deakins. I think that Dunkirk would be a very viable, you know, thing to mark down on your ballot. But at the same time, I think it's all Deakins this year. And I hope it is, because he's earned it.
All right, we got.
But that's one particular category that I think not a lot of people talk about.
Yeah, and, you know, and I got to say that Blake isn't just wax poetic about cinematography. About 26 hours ago, we were at the Brass Rail in Champaign, which, if anyone knows what that bar is, it is the diviest of the dive bars. And Kill Bill 2, Blake, was it?
Volume 1 was on this
little TV, this tube TV. And Blake was like, stop, everyone. Look at this one shot in Kill Bill. It's shot like it's one shot, but it's not. And look at the movement and the focus. And let's give props to the guy
In the club.
Yes, and Blake was like, you got to pay attention to the focus on this and how well the focus is. So
I mean, that was a cool shot.
And it was really cool. I'm just saying that Blake Stubbs, even in a drunken stupor, is caring about cinematography at a dive bar in Champaign, Illinois. Blake, you're going to stick around on the line. You're going to give us more predictions, okay?
Absolutely.
Quick break here on 720 WGN. WGN, and a happy Sunday morning, everyone. It's Esmeralda Leon and myself, John Hanson, filling in for Dave Plyer, who was in earlier
on the WGN Radio Theater.
Did a great job. We've covered two topics today, and we will continue to cover the Oscars here with Blockbuster Blake. We also talked about Esmeralda's eating habits in bed. And I'm going to connect the two, okay? Oh. Movies and Esmeralda eating in bed and her love for it. Essentially, Esmeralda, your dream life would be one of the four grandparents in Willy Wonka, where you just lay in bed all day. I'm sure they ate in bed.
It seemed a bit crowded.
Can we talk, like you're on
like
the line, right?
King size bed.
Can we all talk about this? Why were all four grandparents in the same king size bed?
Because they couldn't afford anything else.
My grandparents wouldn't even be in the same room, like both sets on both sides of the family. They wouldn't get together for anything.
When
they
you're
were
real
neighbors.
Poor,
they were neighbors.
When you're real poor, you can't complain.
But
the
like,
bed or nothing.
I was gonna say, I think all they had was one room, John.
Right.
I'm not quite sure.
I'm not judging. I'm not trying to judge. But, like, I understand they're poor, but can't, like, when someone comes home and, like, Charlie's excited about something, at least two of them get out of bed to give him a hug or a high five or something.
Yeah,
like,
but they could barely.
Yeah, because they've been laying in bed. Esmeralda, this is your future. If you continue to eat full meals in bed, you will one day.
Yeah, but I don't lay there motionless. I move around. I roll around.
You go on your elbow.
Yeah.
My gosh.
That's some arm strength, man. Come on.
Anyways, I'm happy that I connected those dots.
I thought you were going to ask, what is the perfect movie food for Blake? But okay.
Ooh.
That's for the texters.
Like, what do you like to eat when you go to the movies?
What are you eating? What
What's
are you chomping
go-to?
On?
Well, if I'm watching a movie, I mean, I kind of treat it much like being at the movie theater. I'd likely do some candy. And by candy, I mean like Skittles or Reese's Pieces.
Ooh.
I'm pretty streamlined in terms of what I eat when I'm at the movies. So I would just do the same thing at home.
Okay. No
you know
popcorn?
What I mean? Like, I don't want to change it up. Well, no, not really. I mean, I'll eat it. I definitely do. It's just it's never always my go-to. And I think it's
begrudgingly.
Because, like, for me, like, begrudgingly. I mean, I will reluctantly eat that. No. The thing is, like, usually I just want some sugar, but, like, I'll buy a bag of Skittles or something, and, like, I'll eat half of it. And then I'm like, oh, that'll be for the next time. And I'm one of those guys that'll go to a movie, you know, twice in one weekend if, you know, multiple things have come out or there's stuff I need to see to review or talk about.
So you bring your leftovers.
I bring leftovers.
Do you store them in a special, in one of the seats, and then you come back for them later?
Right, the same one.
No, it's kind of like in Fargo when they stash the diamonds, like,
yes.
Just, like, stash them, and then I go
You're
back
stashing
to their
your Skittles.
Yeah.
Oh, that
no,
is...
no, no.
Okay, so let's get back to the what we came here to speak about,
right.
The actual movies and the Oscars. What should we go to next?
Yeah, what category are you expecting, like, a big surprise in?
You know, honestly, I'm thinking that right now, surprise, and I think there's a legitimate battle in the category is best supporting actress.
Oh,
I'm really looking for. So, to give you just a quick glance at who the nominees are, you know, Mary J. Blige, who should be completely familiar to anyone who's ever listened to good music, is nominated for Mudbound. She also sang the song that the film is nominated for as well. Allison Janney, who many will know from The West Wing, or Mom,
Roseanne.
Sitcom. And then Laurie Metcalf from Roseanne, who's also a Steppenwolf member. So I know the Chicagoland area will know Laurie Metcalf. Leslie Manville for Phantom Thread, and then Octavia Spencer, who has won in this category, for The Shape of Water. I think that the real battle is between Janney and Metcalf. So Tonya is one key nominee. Outside of, you know, Tonya herself, Margot Robbie, and then Laurie Metcalf for playing the mom in Lady Bird.
Although
both
Leslie Manville's character in Phantom Thread was the best, in my opinion.
She was phenomenal. She was phenomenal. And it where I find her performance, you know, its greatness is in the subtlety.
Right.
She's,
this little
she's
snarky things.
Yeah, and she's much more downplayed and sort of, you know, controlled and reserved compared to, you know, Allison Janney's character, who is this, you know, mother of Tonya Harding, and the way that she portrays her is just so, like, you love to hate her. She's just that good. And it's a career, you know, performance for her. And look, she's never bad. Okay, I just saw her on Broadway last year, and I was just stunned at how good she is.
And
but,
it's quite a transformation, too, right,
it
for
is,
Tonya? I'm seeing a picture of her. I'm like, oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. The makeup effects on her were outstanding. I mean, they aged her considerably. They gave her, you know, and all of that is just the physicality of the role is not something I would downplay because, again, you know, just because someone's not doing, you know, figure skating doesn't mean that it's not an incredibly demanding physical role. And Janny, I think, really kind of tapped into this angry person on every level, physically, mentally. Like, it was just all, she was that person. She did it. She channeled it. And then Laurie Metcalf's performance is just so real. So many people can relate to the type of person that she was playing. And some people may find a lot of similarities in their own, you know, when you can have a performance that is that real. I think it's easy to connect with, and I think it's not a reason to count her out. Right now, my prediction would be that Allison Janney takes home the trophy tomorrow.
Okay.
But I don't want to write off Laurie Metcalf. I really don't. It's as far as Lady Bird goes and all of the buzz that it garnered, you know, when it had the 100% on Rotten Tomatoes and all of those things, Laurie Metcalf, for me, was the number one standout element. Greta Gerwig, you know, directing and writing that film, did a stellar job, but she also got some incredible acting talent to step in front of her camera. And Metcalf is the number one in my eyes. So it's that's a tight battle. That whole category is outstanding. Everyone's great. But those two are the ones that I would pay attention to. So there might be a little bit of a surprise, but
yeah.
That's where my ballot, you know, has been back and forth the last couple of days. Like, who am I going to vote for in that
right.
category? And right now, my vote is leaning toward Allison Janney.
312-981-7200, text or talk if you would like to weigh in on this year's Oscars. But I also want to introduce the question of Oscar snubs, because I think that a lot of people maybe haven't seen all the movies this year. So to just include everyone, if there's a movie that you've ever seen and loved and you can't believe when you find out that it didn't win Best Picture, there's plenty of them out there. Everyone's kind of got one that they're either going to be convinced should have won and don't. And it's also fascinating to look back, and at the time decisions even seem okay, but looking back they seem a little silly. I think that one of the most fascinating years for Best Picture has to be the ones that came out in 94. So the 95 Oscars included nominees for Best Picture, including iconic films Pulp Fiction, Shawshank Redemption, and Forrest Gump. Now, Esmeralda, when I name those three, do you know which one won or not?
I do.
Okay. Do you think that it was Forrest Gump?
Yes.
But a lot of people feel like that was a huge snub to Pulp Fiction and maybe to Shawshank Redemption as well. Obviously, there's a lot of great movies in certain years and nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
Do you think they got it right that year?
You know, I do love Forrest Gump. It's a very epic movie compared to the other two, but Pulp Fiction was pretty great.
I know. Blake, what do you think of those three? Because I know a lot of people have an opinion on the 1995 Oscars.
Well, that was a very contentious year as far as Best Picture went, for sure. In fact, I wanted to pull up the entire slate. But yes, for me, Shawshank Redemption, for a lot of people, is the greatest movie ever made. IMDb lists it very high, which shows the audience's, you know, votes and confidence in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Pulp Fiction, you know, did take home the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay, and compared to the other films that year, I would agree that was the exact right move. Forrest Gump was this epic story about your average Joe guy that just, it all, you know what I mean? It's comedic at times,
right.
But it also had ways of ripping your heart out. And I think that to the voters that year, that's what spoke. But I also want to mention Quiz Show, that was nominated against it. That is a brilliant film that, if you've never seen, and by the way, compared to the three we just spoke of, you probably haven't. But if you have, you know that there were great performances in it. It was a very interesting story because it actually was based on actual events with, you know, the trivia show that it ended up being a fix. And then, you know, the public found out about it, and it was this big, you know, disgrace and this whole thing. Like, TV was supposed to be this magical, real thing, and in this case, it wasn't. The other mention is Four Weddings and a Funeral, which was a fine film in its own right. But when you look at that big three, like you mentioned, I get why they went with Forrest Gump. I think it probably should have been Shawshank Redemption, and I'm glad that Pulp Fiction was considered, and it certainly, you know, deserved its original screenplay.
Yeah, some years you just can't pick. Yeah. I think that a lot of people are, there's a few recent ones that I know people feel like snubs. In 2010, I was a huge fan of King's Speech, and I still think it stands up, but a lot of people were surprised that Black Swan didn't win, or The Social Network, that was that year. Even Toy Story 3 was in that category. The Fighter was there. Yeah, that was a great year, but some people are like, now, I mean, and some people then they go to the promotional side of things, and that you know, we can't say his name that much anymore, but Harvey Weinstein is a good promoter of his own movies, or certainly was, and can help push those sorts of things on people. But, and Blake, you mentioned this one in the last hour, Brokeback Mountain losing to Crash. Was it Crash when it lost? I think it was.
Yeah.
And I know Crash was one of the most controversial picks for Best Picture. And I'm just shocked looking back that Brokeback Mountain didn't win that year.
Yeah, I mean, Brokeback Mountain taking, you know, Best Achievement in Directing was exactly what I figured it would win. I also, you know, felt like it was going to, you know, get adapted screenplay. Like, this film did very well. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it did very well. It was kind of an art house film. It was a much smaller film. It was one of those films that, you know, you're glad that finally Hollywood is paying attention to the types of films that it should, not just the stuff that it's used to paying attention to. And that was a really big year. I mean, Crash, Capote, Munich, Good Night and Good Luck, and Brokeback Mountain. And yes, Crash won, and a lot of people have had issues with that. It's a fine film. It brings a lot of attention to real issues that I think audiences can easily connect to. So the fact that it won, you know, for me, that
was... It was preachy. I don't like preachy movies.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the straight-up reason why a lot of people have always had a problem with it. And, I, you know, a brief correction to myself earlier. You know, Memoirs of a Geisha is what won Best Cinematography that year. And I felt Brokeback Mountain did deserve it. But Memoirs of a Geisha, it was a Rob Marshall film. His films are always beautiful. Mm-hmm. And in no way was I surprised that it won. You know what I mean? Like, it's one of those things where that's a great category to pay attention to because it's so non-mainstream compared to what everybody else, you know, likes to, you know, you can pick your best actor, you can pick your best picture or this or that or the other. But cinematography, we're watching movies. They're moving pictures. Cinematography is the basis of all of this. So I always want to, you know, point people in that direction. Mm-hmm. And I think in this case, yeah, Brokeback Mountain probably should have won Best Picture over Crash, at least. Good Night and Good Luck was a fun, you know what I mean? Like, this was a great,
And
that was, you know, a few years before they moved on to doing up to 10 nominees.
Right.
So that was still back when they only did 5. And it was probably a little easier to pick, you know, back then, because you don't have to see as much or think about, you know, the implications of why they're going to choose this or choose that.
Or what the reaction is going to be on social media afterwards and how big of a story. No, really. I mean, like, it's just overtaking these awards.
Yeah, that wasn't happening.
No,
I was gonna go with a snub that I am to this day still mad about.
Oh, let's hear it.
I am angry. Best Supporting Actor in 90, I think I looked at it, was 96.
Well, this is a specific thing you're upset about, yes.
Yeah. Edward Norton got the snub. Cuba Gooding Jr. won for Show Me the Money. When Edward Norton in Primal Fear, best villain, like, story. And that movie wasn't even that great, but his performance in it was amazing.
Edward Norton in Primal Fear, and if you are one who has never seen it, you owe it to yourself to watch what a really great supporting role can do for someone's career. That was his first big film.
Yeah.
That was what put him on the map, and rightfully so. I mean, if you're looking at someone like, you know, look who he was acting opposite, you know, Richard Gere and Laura Linney.
Mm-hmm.
Both are, you know, great actors with great careers and people know them. And I wouldn't say Laura Linney at the time was the household name she's become, you know, thanks to television and film. But Edward Norton, if you take anything away from that movie, it's going to be how haunting he was. He will make your blood boil, or he will make you your insides churn. Like, he was so scary.
Sounds like you need
that film. That you need to watch it. You need to see it. I mean, it's one of those genuinely frightening performances. And yes, he did lose to Cuba Gooding Jr. Who, by the way, that was
still mad about it.
Yeah, I can tell. Man, that is a specific one. Blake, we got to take a quick commercial break because we have to. Because rules. I don't know. Because it's that time. We're going to talk a little bit about some more Oscar snubs. 312-981-7200. Call or text. Everyone's got one. I know Blake and I share one very similar one. A movie from the 70s. A big one. One of our favorites that is a huge snub. Blake and I are going to talk about that.
I was going to say West Wing is a TV show. That can't be nominated for an Oscar.
No, don't worry. That got every single award and it deserved every single one. Probably should have deserved more. More on 720 on WGN. 720 WGN. John Hanson, Esmeralda Leon, filling in for Dave Plyer. We're talking about Oscars and Oscar snubs with Blockbuster Blake. And we've got Mike on the line. Mike joining us from Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin. Did I just hang up on Blake accidentally there, Curtis?
I think you did.
I just hit one button. What'd
Blake,
I do?
Blake was so
incensed. Get him queued up
yeah,
for
Blake
you.
Will get him queued up. Mike, why don't you go ahead and share us which movie you thought was a little bit of a snub in, I think we're going back to the 70s, right, Mike?
Yeah, you mentioned 70s right before whatever announcement you had a few minutes ago. One of my favorite movies of the 70s was Dog Day Afternoon with Al Pacino. It had everything, and I don't know if to this day if it got any Academy Awards at all. That's my first comment. I have another one. Does anybody there know if Dog Day Afternoon got
any? Yeah, that's a great movie.
So I have got, we were pulling this up, it did receive, of course, a critical acclaim when it came out in September 75. It was nominated for several Academy Awards and Golden Globe Awards, and it won the Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay. So it did win one award there for Best Original Screenplay.
Yeah, and the storyline on that for the 70s?
Right.
When I first saw it, I was like, wait, when did this happen?
Right.
Just that whole storyline of him getting the money
right.
for his boyfriend who wants a sex change operation. This is 1975.
Blake, your thoughts on Dog Day Afternoon, and sorry to Mike who called in. We got to get moving along, so I dropped you off the line. But Blake, your thoughts on Dog Day Afternoon?
It is that movie is a tour de force as far as acting goes. It's also brilliantly directed and executed. It really helps create both a claustrophobic and a very erratic powder keg type atmosphere with, you know, the robbery of a bank with a very personal agenda behind why the bank is being robbed. Because, yes, Al Pacino's character Sonny is robbing the bank so that his boyfriend, played by Chris Sarandon, both of those actors were nominated, by the way, for leading actor and supporting actor, respectively. It was one of those films that definitely was turning that whole this is what Hollywood is in terms of the movies they're making on its head at the time. And I think that, you know, the recognition that it did receive was very worth it. I mean, I agree with it. I think that all those nominations were right on. That was a tough year, though.
I was just going to say, Blake, because that's where our spoiler mining use, or not spoiler, but snubs comes in. We both love, and you want to go ahead and say it, Blake.
Well, and it was the following year, but Jaws had some serious snubs.
But Jaws was in the same category as Dog Day Afternoon, and then the winner, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So, yes, I want to say that Jaws is a big snub, and so is Dog Day Afternoon, but Cuckoo's Nest is incredible.
Yeah, that is a great movie.
It is. It is. And Cuckoo's Nest, really, that was Cuckoo's Nest. That was its Oscars. I mean, it, you know, best director, best actor, it was one of those movies that I think because of the way it was showcasing a part of society that most of the everyday average Joe tries to ignore or is completely ignorant to. And the fact that, you know, Jack Nicholson's character is crazy, but he's not crazy. And the torture, you know, in their minds that goes on with these people. And by the way, Brad Dourif, who was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, who went on to be the voice of Chucky the Killer Doll, is a phenomenal actor, by the way, Brad Dourif. And if you're not familiar, but you're like, wait a minute, the guy that played Billy Bibbit, he was amazing.
Oh, I loved Billy.
He's the voice of Chucky?
The voice of Chucky.
Oh.
And there is another performance of his that I cannot recommend enough for people. And again, this is what the Oscars do to me. Like, there's a lot of, well, this person did this and this was great, but they didn't win the award, but they've also gone on to do these other things. His performance as Doc Cochran on Deadwood, HBO series Deadwood, is one of the finest supporting roles from any actor I have ever seen. He is a phenomenal talent, and Milos Forman and everybody who, you know, worked with him on that film knew it. I'm glad that the Academy recognized a rookie at the time.
Yeah.
In fact, he was nominated for, he did win a Golden Globe for being, you know, a debut actor in a film that year. So, I mean, he didn't go without accolade.
Right.
Okay. But the fact that he was nominated and while he didn't win, you know, George Burns won for the Sunshine Boys. But when the company that he was with, Chris Sarandon, Jack Warden, Burgess Meredith, that's a pretty big step. And, you know, similarly this year, there's a couple of rookies that are up for best director.
We're going to get to those. Yeah, no, we'll, like, yeah. Unfortunately, we got to hit the news here, but we'll get to director. And we got to obviously get the best picture, but we're mm-hmm. getting a bunch of texts coming in on big snubs, too. So please keep those texts coming. Biggest Oscar snubs that you can remember, whether it's a specific film, specific actor over the years, whatever it is, 312-981-7200. You can talk or text in. But it is 3:30, and the man who always deserves all the accolades, all the awards. He's never been snubbed in his life.
Oh, you shouldn't know from it.
What'd you say?
You shouldn't know from it.
What's that? What are you? What's that from?
It's a Yiddish type
of
phrase.
Okay.
Yeah, you shouldn't know from it.
You shouldn't know from it.
Yeah.
Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
I've never heard that before.
With a little accent.
Yeah, you got to throw a little.
You shouldn't know for it.
From it. Get it right.
You shouldn't know for it, from it,
you
to
practice
it.
While I do the news.
Whatever, 3:31, here's Roger. Woo! 720 WGN, John Hanson and Esmeralda Leon filling in for Dave Plyer here on this Sunday morning, and we're joined by Blockbuster Blake. I always want to say Block Bluster Blake.
Oh, I was thinking, was in the 90s, was it Blockbuster Video Blake?
That was Family Video Blake in the 1990s. Blake, we're talking about all things Oscars, Oscar snubs, or predictions for tonight. 312-981-7200. A movie, actor, something that you are cannot believe didn't win their category, or when you look back, you say, how the heck did that film not win? We had a text from the 312 saying, I've always felt it was a crying shame that Cary Grant never won a Best Actor, especially for the movie North by Northwest. Thank you, Steve, for that text. Blake, your thoughts on Cary Grant?
I can agree with that. That is, you are not the only one who thinks that. Or to at least, you know, I mean, he did win an honorary award in 1970, but the fact that he was never even nominated for North by Northwest, which is an incredibly fine film and one worth studying if you want to know how to make a great movie. I would agree with that 100%. He was a fine actor. He was nominated twice. He never won, but he did get, you know, the honorary Oscar later in life. Cary Grant was a giant of classic Hollywood, for sure.
It's amazing when you look at names of Oscars of people that have never won. Mm-hmm. And you know one name that comes up a lot, and Esmeralda, I don't know if you feel this is true or not, and Blake, your thoughts. At least I don't think he's won, or at least not for Best Actor. Tom Cruise, has he ever won an Oscar?
No.
No,
he hasn't.
He has not.
And is that a crying shame?
Not.
Because I know a lot of people, you know, whatever you feel about him personally and the Scientology stuff and all that may play a role in that, who knows, but...
He's nominated, though, right?
Has he been? I don't know.
Yes. He's had three nominations. He was nominated for Born on the 4th of July. Yeah. He was nominated for Jerry Maguire. And he was also nominated for a supporting role
in Rain Man?
Thomas Anderson's. In Magnolia.
Oh, okay.
Magnolia. So, yeah, no, he was not even considered for Rain Man. But Born on the 4th of July, that is a. If you've never seen that film, that is a big one. However, that year, he would have been hard-pressed to beat the man who did win, which was Daniel Day-Lewis for My Left Foot.
Oh,
yeah.
That was his first. But he was also opposite Robin Williams for Dead Poets Society, Morgan Freeman for Driving Miss Daisy, and Kenneth Branagh for Henry V.
That's rough.
Henry V was a great sequel to the... It was the best of the Henrys.
Of the best of the Henrys. Certainly.
Henry I was
like
good.
Henry VIII, but...
Yeah, no, by then it gets a little old... By the eighth Henry, you kind of know what's coming. I don't know what
franchises
I'm talking about.
Franchises dwindle, man. Franchises dwindle. That's the easiest way to say it.
Right.
Tom Cruise. I mean, he's one of the biggest movie stars in the world.
You mentioned us.
You can't argue.
Yeah. You mentioned Best Supporting Actor, which I think these supporting categories are where we get sometimes some surprises that come along. Mm-hmm. One, Blake, that I know we've talked about, Mr. Stubbs, is,
yes.
I believe it was 93 movies, so the 94 awards is... Tommy Lee Jones wins Best Supporting Actor for The Fugitives, beating out one of the best performers of all time in Schindler's List.
Oh.
Yeah, which was Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah.
For playing the role of Amon Goth or Amon Gotha.
Probably one of the biggest movie villains of all time. I mean, real life villains, of course, mm-hmm. but in the movies. Yeah. I mean, one of the most villainous creatures. And I love The Fugitive, and I love Tommy Lee Jones in it. And maybe he deserved it. I don't know. It's kind of that's that when you're talking about different genres of movies and different tones and everything, you know, these are hard categories to pick one winner.
It is. I would say this was the beginning, though, of the true snub fest that carried on until The Revenant. Leonardo DiCaprio that same year was nominated for Best Supporting Actor opposite Tommy Lee Jones, Ralph Fiennes, Pete Postlewaite, and John Malkovich. But DiCaprio's performance in What's Eating Gilbert Grape
so good.
Is one of the most touching, it is one of the most endearing, and it is one of, at times, even heart-wrenching performances by a young actor that I think anybody has ever seen, period. I think that it showed his true talent. It showed the, you know, because up till that point, he was kind of only really known as the kid from Growing Pains. You know what I mean? Like, he was an up-and-coming talent. He very much was. But that is a career-making role for a young man, and to be in that company of the people that he was in this category, the talent there is huge. But the fact that Tommy Lee Jones beat out, to me, DiCaprio and Ralph Fiennes is... it's crazy. I think it was one of those things where it happened. Okay, I'm going to move on. But I would agree. I would agree that was a big snub for both DiCaprio and Fiennes.
What's Eating Gilbert Grape is so good.
What about Romeo and Juliet? Anybody? No? Okay, fine.
Whatever. He was good. Well, here's the thing. DiCaprio's never bad. He's always very good. There's just certain films that I think... if you go on to know that, you know, DiCaprio was going to be in something as huge as Titanic, okay, right. or as stylistic as Romeo and Juliet, or as, you know, raw and gritty as The Revenant.
Basketball Diaries.
Basketball Diaries, the same thing. You know, What's Eating Gilbert Grape is a much more independent in spirit type of film. Mm-hmm. And so for an actor to get that kind of nomination at such a young age in a film that, you know, comparatively, like to the rest of the stuff that was nominated that year, doesn't really fall into the same category as anything else. That's a standout element to the performance, I think, in terms of appraising it. And I think that he, over time, you know, honed his craft. I think he definitely has had close calls. And then finally, mm-hmm. when he won, it was deserved, in my opinion. But at the same time, you could have gone all the way back to the Oscars in 94 and given him a statue for What's Eating Gilbert Grape. Mm-hmm. I stand by that.
Now, you mentioned Daniel Day-Lewis earlier that he yep. won for My Left Foot. He this is his last movie, right? Phantom Thread that he was just in, and
that
he's nominated?
That's the rumor.
Do you think...
This is his swan song. Do I think he's going to win?
Do you think he has any chance?
I think he has a chance. I don't think he's going to win it, though. I think this category, the whole category, just so you know, the mm-hmm. company in that category is Daniel Day-Lewis. From Phantom Thread, Timothy Chalamet for Call Me By Your Name, Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out, Gary Oldman for Darkest Hour, and Denzel Washington for Roman J. Israel Esquire. This is Gary Oldman's Oscar.
Oh, okay.
There were other roles that he's played that he could have won an Oscar for, but this is going to be Gary Oldman's Oscar. I don't have any problem marking Gary Oldman. I wouldn't even second guess it. I think this is going to be his year. But because his Winston Churchill in Darkest Hour it's fantastic. It's human. It's flawed. And yet it's exquisite. You know, it's just one of those things where playing Winston Churchill is kind of like a rite of passage for great English actors at this point.
Mm-hmm.
but Gary Oldman's portrayal, I think, really takes the audience inside what it was like to be either the man himself or near the man during the time when he assumed power. He didn't really ask for it. The country, you can go through the annals of history, mm-hmm. fewer times especially when a world war was about to break out or already going on in some cases, did a country need a real leader that they had confidence in. And this is that's the story that's being told here.
Yeah.
It's a little different than, you know, the likes of Dunkirk, which is taking place around a military, you know, campaign incident, whereas this is much more introspective about the man himself, what he was going through, the stresses of trying to be a political leader when a lot of his contemporaries don't necessarily back him up. They don't believe in him. Mm-hmm. And he was there's that English bulldog, you know, image, the British bulldog, and the way that Oldman, you know, grows as an actor in this film, it's refreshing. And again, he's amongst great company here. Everybody in this category was outstanding, but I think this is going to be Gary Oldman's year, finally.
All right, so we still have to break down Best Director, right? We got to do Best Actress and, of course, Best Picture. So we're going to do that after this commercial break. And also, any more Oscar snubs you want to get in, 312-981-7200, give us a text. We'll talk about all that and wrap up the Oscar talk with Blockbuster Video Blake on 720 WGN. WGN. Happy Sunday morning, everybody. John Hanson and Esmeralda Leon filling in for Dave Plyer, who filled in for Carl earlier. Mm-hmm. So he's just moved his shift up a few hours. And we're talking with Blake Stubbs, Blockbuster Blake, about all things the Oscars, which, of course, are tonight. And, Blake, we've been talking about snubs. We've been talking about predictions. Really quickly, you got a snub that you wanted to mention. It's not a name that people may know in the households, but maybe they should for all the pioneering he's done in a certain field.
Correct. I think that this is a big discussion that should happen in the near future for the Academy, for Hollywood Foreign Press, for all the award, you know, categories that are out there that honor acting. Andy Serkis is the man's name. He is probably known to a lot of people. He played Gollum or Smeagol in the Lord of the Rings films, where his entire performance up until they did show him as Smeagol, younger, live action, but it was all motion capture. Most recently, he was seen as Caesar in War for the Planet of the Apes. He's played Caesar in all of these films. He also was Supreme Leader Snoke in Star Wars The Last Jedi. What he is doing is actually portraying a character. He's playing it. He has rigging that's put up on his face so that they can capture all the nuance of his performance. It is not as simple as the guy is voicing a character and it's all created through CGI. His movements, his performance is something that actually is being captured and put onto screen.
Does he do the voice too then, or does he do the voice as well?
He does the voice, yes. He does it all live.
Can he not be nominated in other categories, or is he just not nominated because it doesn't take on the look of him as that person?
It's really a whole conversation that they haven't even tried to, you know, open up yet. For example, this film, War for the Planet of the Apes, is nominated for Best Visual Effects this year. I think it's going to win Best Visual Effects. I think it should win Best Visual Effects. But every time he does one of these films, and again, I focus in on him because of the volume that he has done of this kind of work and has been one of the leading pioneers in getting other actors to do this. It's like a whole facet of acting for cinema that is just not even acknowledged yet. They don't know how to, you know, reword the criteria. Maybe they need to create a new category. Do you know what I'm saying? It needs to open up soon because there's great, truly great performances. Like,
Characters though considered supporting actor or actor in a leading role?
Well, see, this is the interesting part. For War for the Planet of the Apes, that's the third film in a trilogy, right? So far. That they're telling the Planet of the Apes, lore. They're expanding it out and making it more modern. He was more of a supporting role in the first two, but in the third, he was 100% the leading actor of the film. He was the leading actor. There was no question about who had the most screen time, who had the bigger impact on the narrative. It was Andy Serkis. There was another actor opposite him, which was Steve Zahn, who could have been nominated for a supporting role. But again, it's this whole, because it's motion capture, it's not really acknowledged.
It's interesting because you look at Gary Oldman, who, you know, gets transformed into Winston Churchill. Yes. You look at Ralph Fiennes and all the characters he's done that he's been transformed. Other actors that never, Gary Oldman, they never look like the character they're playing, and they're just using makeup and prosthetics. What's the difference between little balls all over their face and to capture the thing? I mean, it should just be the same thing. They should at least certainly just be considered for the main acting categories, or is it a matter of we have to start a whole new category, Blake?
See, and that, I think that's the big question. What I'm trying to propose is that the Academy needs to address this in the next couple of years. If they're going to be all about change and they're going to be all about, you know, branching out and diversifying the way that they approach, you know, finding nominees or accepting nominees or anything like that, this entire facet of acting for cinema needs recognition.
Yeah.
And until the Academy does it, because again, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is still, it's seen as the preeminent. It is the end all be all. To win an Oscar is the biggest accolade one can win. And I think that it would be very crucial to start acknowledging these types of performances, because to be honest with you, if you are able to, you know, see any behind the scenes footage of Andy Serkis in Planet of the Apes films, any one of them, to be honest with you, you start to see how much of a performer he is. Now, granted, he gets mostly character roles and other things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just in Black Panther and he was awesome in that.
Mm-hmm.
But for the fact that he has put so much effort into creating these magical performances, and I say magical because, yes, he's wearing a skin tight suit and he's got dots all over his face and he's wearing a camera rig that, you know, is capturing all the nuance of what his face does for movement, and it matches it up with what we end up seeing in the final product. He's doing that.
Yeah, it's not a computer editor. It's not an editor in a computer bay later on. Hey, Blake, I think that's a great one. We only have six more minutes, so I want to make sure we get to you wrapping up these last three categories. So 2 minutes apiece. Let's talk about Best Actress.
Best Actress. Well, this year you got representatives from most of the films we've already mentioned, with one exception being The Post. Meryl Streep, Queen Streep, is nominated. Saoirse Ronan for Lady Bird, Margot Robbie for I, Tonya, Frances McDormand for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and finally Sally Hawkins for The Shape of Water. This is a great category. These are all great performances.
Who will win? Who should win? I think that's what those two questions.
I think it's the answer to both for me. Is going to be Frances McDormand for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. I think she deserves it, and I think that she will. I think she has all the steam going in. She's already won the Golden Globe. I believe she cleaned up the SAG-AFTRA. Steam going into tomorrow's broadcast is really in her favor. But that's not to count out any of these other women, because to be quite honest with you, I loved every one of them and the parts that they played. They were stellar.
I think that if Meryl Streep loses tomorrow, though, I think her career is really on thin ice.
Right.
I don't know if she has much to back. This is it for her.
Yeah, I think she'll take a brief break.
Yes.
But I think we will have not seen the last of Meryl Streep. At least I hope not.
Best director.
Best director. You're looking at Christopher Nolan for Dunkirk, Jordan Peele for Get Out, Greta Gerwig for Lady Bird, Paul Thomas Anderson for Phantom Thread, and The Shape of Water's Guillermo del Toro. As of right now, I think it's pretty much a lock that Guillermo del Toro is going to win this award. He already won the DGA, which, like I said earlier, is about 90%+ accurate in, you know, picking this particular category. Jordan Peele and Greta Gerwig are rookies. This is Get Out and Lady Bird were respectively their first films. They did write and direct those films. Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread, he writes, he directs, he edits, he shoots, he does it all. He's been nominated 8 times and never won. Del Toro's been nominated 3 times and never won. Christopher Nolan's got multiple nominations, but this is the first time he's ever been nominated for Best Director. I would say if anybody has a chance in my mind, or who I would vote for over Del Toro, it would be Nolan. That film was, Dunkirk was an epic. It was an epic on every scale. It certainly, you know, harkens back to the type of filmmaking you saw in the 40s and 50s, where everything you see on the screen, when it can be, was real. Of course, they use CGI in places, and they added extra bodies digitally and blah, blah, blah. But they used real planes, real boats, real actors, real sailors, real pilots, everything to make that movie feel as accurate as it could possibly be. So I would maybe not write him off, but for me, it's going to be Del Toro.
All right.
A beautiful film he made. Can't skip it.
You've got 2 minutes, Blake, to do Best Picture.
Yeah.
Because I know this one has a lot of stuff.
So there's 9 nominees. Call Me by Your Name, Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, Get Out, Lady Bird, Phantom Thread, The Post, Shape of Water, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. There's only 3 films in here that I think are going to have a really good chance of walking out with that statue. The Shape of Water is the most nominated film this year. That's the one a lot of people are picking and putting on their ballots. I think it's probably going to win. I would like to see Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri take home that statue, but also Get Out is a film I don't want to write off. It came out the earliest of any film in this category, and it also has stuck with me and the people who saw it so vividly, and so it's such a film for right now. And I think that tomorrow, if it were to be the dark horse that upsets The Shape of Water, that would be fantastic. And Three Billboards shares a lot of commonality, I think, with Get Out in terms of talking about modern day issues being very much in the now. You know, people calling each other out on their crap, redemption stories for Three Billboards. This is a tough category. It's the toughest it's been in years, and those are the big three that I would say one of them is going to take it home tomorrow.
I think that it's always an interesting thing to look at the behind the scenes and the balloting and how that all works. A lot of people feel like perhaps what could happen is that Three Billboards and The Shape of Water kind of split votes for people that only look at the more recent ones. That's the popular choices, and then that's how you get a one that people hadn't considered. That's how you get a winner, because you don't need a majority. Yep. You just need the most. You need the plurality, and that's sometimes those votes get split around.
Yep, that's correct. And again, like I said, tough category. It is, and I'm excited to see what happens. More so than I was last year when I was pretty confident that one film would win, and then they had that whole fiasco, and then it ended up winning anyway. This year, I think it's genuinely, there could be a surprise in this category. And I hope that there is. Yeah. I hope that in the end, you know, all of these are great films. People should watch them.
As long as it's not a surprise for the presenter.
They're bringing them back.
Oh,
did you hear that?
Oh, Warren Beatty's going to do it again?
Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway.
Oh, they got him. I'm sure they'll do a bit of some kind.
Yeah, we'll find out.
Blake, why didn't Baywatch get nominated for anything? Where is that on?
That should have been a sweep.
That should have been a sweep of them all.
Anybody who has heard me on WGN this year, in the last year, knows that I did review Baywatch and talked about how it was just a massive miss. Everything about that movie missed.
Really?
No.
It's weird because it's a movie that has a lot of people involved that I'm a fan of, but nothing clicked. I sat and watched
it. Like, I wasn't actually asking for you to review Baywatch again. I was making a joke.
But we know it's bad. Well,
the only thing that was a joke was the movie itself.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a good one.
That even gave you the top of the hour tone. That's how good that joke was, Blake. Blake, as always, thanks so much for joining us, man. Get some sleep, okay?
Thank you. You guys have a great one and enjoy Oscar Sunday.
I will. I'll be in bed eating a rotisserie chicken.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently.
You should.
Yes, I should. Okay. This,
in a bow tie.
Exactly. We got some really great stuff coming on. We've got a veteran coming on to talk about a really awesome program he started and works on. It's awesome stuff. I cannot wait to talk to him. That'll be coming up after the news. WGN 720 WGN, John Hanson, Esmeralda Leon filling in for Dave Plyer here. Happy Sunday morning to you. And we're joined now by Carter Davis, a retired Navy corpsman.
Yes, sir.
I've said that correctly now.
You have.
And give us a little bit of your background, Carter. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Beaverton, Oregon. I was born and raised out in Oregon, Nike Town, USA. Mm-hmm. Got Nike there, Intel there. Really cool, innovative place to grow up. And then I joined the military in 2007.
And you served in the military for 6 years, and 6 or 7 years, right? And you suffered an injury in 2013 and separated from the military after that. And that's when your journey changes. That's where a lot of...
That's where it began, that's where really.
Really? Yeah. So talk about that, because, you know, a lot of veterans, every veteran, when they come home from their service, whatever service it is, they face different battles when they get home. Some people are, it's a breeze, it's no problem. Some people face transitional issues. Some people, there's mental health issues. What was your transition home like?
So you're hitting the nail on the head there. The organization and what we are trying to do is help veterans transition from military life to civilian life, because that transition is so individualistic for everyone. Like you just said, everyone goes through a different experience through that transition. But the one thing that really culminates through the transition for everyone is a reinvention of yourself. And, you know, a lot of veterans are getting out of the service. They're not getting access to the benefits that they're needing access to because of kind of a delayed system. Mm-hmm. We've got, you know, service members getting out of the service with injuries or mental health problems and stuff like that. And so, you know, what my organization, Lift for the 22, is trying to do is we are trying to help fix that transition through fitness.
And when we talk about that transition and the individual thing, I mean, we can talk about this on many different scopes, what our government can do better to help out. But there's a lot of things that individual civilians who have never spent time in the military can do a lot better job of. And I think that starts, and maybe you'll agree or disagree, with conversations, the open and honest conversations between people. I think that there's often not a wall, but there's something between people that have been in the military and those that haven't. And we see that in all sorts of line of work. People that have been in a certain business that, you know, there's a language that you guys have that's different than civilian life. But I think that it starts with a conversation between the two.
It does. And probably one of the biggest conversations that really needs to be had is that the transition from military life to civilian life is not just a transfer of a job. It's not just, you know, I'm going from one job to another. I'm going from one lifestyle to another. And for many service members that went in at 18 years old and they get out at 22 to 30, 35, if they spent 20 years in the military, they go through that transition at a different pace. But the biggest thing is a lot of our skills from the military aren't transferring effectively to civilian life. And civilian employers aren't tripling down on the benefits that having a service member within your organization, your company, can have on the impact of leadership. And that's something that we are trying to hit on, is that veterans get out of the service with leadership qualities that need to be recognized by the civilian side of the community. So if civilian business owners are out there, look to hire veterans. We're coming back and we're not having a lot of the skills that we had in the military being able to transfer effectively out here, especially through certifications. That's probably the biggest issue the DOD needs to fix, is that the certifications for our jobs, they don't transition effectively.
So you mean like the actual language that you used, what that certification means in the military? That doesn't make any on this end of things. It doesn't make sense. Or people don't know how to apply that to a certain job.
Well, like for example, you know, we have the best truck drivers in the world in the military. They get out of the service and they don't have a CDL certificate. They don't have the ability to transfer directly into a $60,000+ a year job that's going to be able to help them provide for their family and for their future. I was a medic in the military. I was capable of placing chest tubes in an austere environment, moving patients over a 24-hour period through the mountains if they had a spinal injury, all kinds of different things. And then I flew CASAVAC missions, my second deployment, picking up patients that were injured and moving them. And I got out of the service and all they handed me was a medical assistant certification, which is, we barely trust you with a pencil with a patient. So, and now I'm in nursing school and I have to go through the whole gambit of nursing school, through the whole program, whole process at 29 years old to get my degree and actually start that next chapter of my life, to start that next career.
So we need to have more conversations between our government and civilian life to try and find out ways to give you those certifications right when you come out. See, that's like a very tangible thing, I think, that we all can work on getting those things done. And it's great you're raising awareness for that stuff. The organization that you founded is Lift for the 22. And we didn't talk about this before you went on air, but that number 22, when I've been reading about it before we went on the air, there's just one thing. I was like, why is it called Lift for the 22? 22, what's this 22? And then I remember that in the last, one of the last presidential elections, that number came up a bunch in terms of the number every single day of former military people that kill themselves.
Yes.
Is that where that number comes? Is that where the number comes from?
That's where the number comes from. And in 2012, the VA released a study where they measured death certificates in a certain amount of states, not all 50 states, but they measured death certificates. And if the death certificate said the veteran was a veteran, served in the military, and their cause of death was suicide, then they added it to the statistic. They came to find that 22 veterans commit suicide a day. In 2016, they redid the study, and they found that 20 veterans commit suicide a day. Either way, that number can be very contentious, whether you're a civilian statistician and you're looking at something, you're going, this number can't possibly be 100% correct because we'll never know the exact number.
Right.
But that's where the movement began, and that's why we're named Lift for the 22.
And not to, you know, obviously we want to share all. You almost became one of those people, right?
Yes, I did. So during my transition from service, I was in a wheelchair for about a year after a non-combat related leg injury. Ended up with a spinal cord stimulator in my spine. My tibia is metal, you know, and I just had to kind of relearn to walk and rebuild my life again. And I started gaining weight and I was addicted to all the meds that the VA was pushing on me.
Yeah.
From antidepressants to anxiety medication. Pain medication was the biggest one they were pumping me full of. And then when I started coming off those medications, I went into a really deep, dark depression, which culminated in me almost committing suicide. And I started using the gym to rebuild my life. And that's where Lift for the 22 came from. It's that I wanted to be able to provide that same fitness opportunity for veterans, no matter where they come home to when they get out of the service. We want to have a gym there that's partnered with our organization to help you get back into civilian life effectively through fitness.
The thing about fitness, and I think the gym, which is so fascinating, and this applies to your situation as well, is that there's both long-term benefits to the gym, of course, health, overall health, the way you look. Yeah. But there's an immediate short-term benefit when you're
Absolutely.
Feeling down. And in particular where you were really down and really contemplating, maybe more than contemplating. I mean, it was that night or shortly after you went to a gym, and it didn't solve everything. But in that moment, what did that feel like? That difference from where you were, you know, making that ultimate decision that thank God you didn't make, to where you felt hours or days later when you finally were able to bring yourself to the gym.
Yeah. So I had two friends show up for me the night that I was going to commit suicide, and they took me to the gym and they beat the living crap out of me. And I just remember laying there on the ground after they slayed me, and I'm looking up at the ceiling, and I just kind of realized the anxiety and the depression that I felt literally an hour before, when I was ready to end my life, was gone. I couldn't even think about it. So the concept is, if you can exhaust your body, you can exhaust your mind. And a lot of people who are out there dealing with depression, anxiety issues, and things like that, this doesn't just work for veterans. This works for everyone. And as a society, we've really moved away from saying that fitness is a great way to manage a lot of these issues, rather than having to go see a physician and having to burden yourself with tons of different medications. Fitness makes a huge difference when it comes to having that short-term benefit and that long-term benefit of all the endorphins and the self-esteem and going to the gym and taking care of goals that you wanted to achieve in the gym, and then you start achieving goals in your life.
Yeah, I think that even for – I think anyone who works out either semi-regularly knows that feeling that you're talking about. And obviously everyone has their own individual ways of dealing with things, but certainly if you're at that point, whether you're a veteran or not, and you can just find your way to whether it's the gym or a nice long walk or something, it's not going to cure everything for the long term, but that certainly is a great place to start. It wasn't only you that was affected. I'm reading here that you lost six friends to suicide. That seems like an incredibly high number. Were most people you served with or veterans you knew, or was it amongst other friends as well? Or
it was amongst acquaintances, friends from my unit, really close friends. Two of my really, really close friends committed suicide. Mm. And they committed suicide after I started this organization. And that actually speaks to the isolation that occurs when someone is getting ready to commit suicide. Some of the warning signs that you should be looking for in a veteran or in a friend that's dealing with some traumas in their life. Both of my friends that were really, really close with me that committed suicide, both isolated. And then the next thing we knew, we got suicide letters and found the bodies.
When you say isolated, and we're not trying to, because obviously the organization will continue to talk about that, but for someone that might be listening now, this could save someone's life. What do you mean when you say isolation? Is it a matter that they're not picking up the phone call anymore? They're not responding to texts, or that their responses are different than they were even a week or a week or 2 weeks before? What does it look like?
Really, what the emotion is burdened. And when someone is burdened, they can be burdened in two different ways. One, they can feel like life is too burdening on them, or that they are tired of feeling anxiety and depression. Maybe they're chemically depressed. Maybe they're constantly feeling like life is difficult to live through every single day. Getting up in the morning is just a hard thing. That is a real lifestyle for a lot of people in this country. And then there's the people who feel like they're a burden on everyone else. And that comes from that inherent first step, which is feeling like your life is burdened, and then therefore I'm exhibiting behaviors that are now burdening my family and my friends, and so they isolate. And when they isolate and they go into that dark place and they start to live inside of their head by themselves going through this, that's when we start to see the action come from those issues.
So what are those actions?
Suicide,
yeah.
And drinking, getting back, starting to become self-destructive in a way, self-destructive behaviors. If you got that friend, that just, was on the right track and then things got derailed a little bit, and you kind of notice that they're secluding a little bit. You're not seeing them on Snapchat or Facebook or Instagram anymore, or you're not seeing them, text messages popping up anymore. Reach out to that person.
Yeah, in this digital age, I imagine that the signs are things that happen on your phone, which seems crazy, but could be a blessing to start recognizing those signs earlier, is that because we do communicate so frequently now with each other. If you notice a steep drop off, to alert someone or just to get over to their darn place and see what you can do. We got to take a quick commercial break, but Carter, I want to talk about Lift for the 22 and all the great things that you guys do and how other people can help, because there's big ways people can help this week. So we're going to have more of that coming up next on 720 WGN. WGN, John Hanson, Esmeralda Leon filling in for Dave Plyer till 5. Carter Davis, founder of Lift for the 22. You were just kind of telling us off the line of how Lift for the 22 got started. Started as what you thought was going to be a social media movement, right?
Yeah, so we originally started the concept as a Facebook page, and it had 2,000 likes overnight with the idea that we were going to encourage veterans to get back into fitness. And it turned into something completely different. And now we partner with gyms all over the nation who donate a few memberships a year to the nonprofit for us to help local veterans. So as we partner with more gyms around the nation, we're capable of helping more people.
And what are you're creating it's not only a lifestyle, a community, what are you creating in a way?
We're creating a movement of gyms around the nation who partner with an organization to go above and beyond the veteran discount, to donate a few memberships a year so that we can fix transition. What we are trying to do is utilize the fitness industry as a whole to fix a big piece of the missing transitional process. When you're in the military, you do fitness 5 days a week with your community. You're in your platoons, mm-hmm. you're in your units, you're running, you're flipping tires, you're getting beat by first sergeant. And now when you get out of the service, let's recreate that camaraderie-based environment, but let's do it under a place of positivity rather than the bar. So let's do it under gyms.
It's amazing that, yeah, you think of people in the military as being the most fit people, and they probably are, especially when they're in the military, because it is, that's just their life. It's a requirement. It's who they are. It is. And I just think of, all military people are so disciplined that when they come home, they're going to work out every single day. But like anyone in any job, when you lose that routine, just like the rest of us, a slight change, a move from one place to the other, and you're just out of whack. Any one of us can then never, even a military person could then not work out for 2 years, 3 years, something like that, just because of their circumstances. So I think that that image of a military person, no matter what, they're going to be at the gym is not accurate.
Absolutely not. Veterans are people just like everyone else.
What?
There are statistics out there. I'm not sure what the exact numbers are, but a very small percentage of people who actually own gym memberships use them. So, and veterans are no different, and the concept of what we're building is get out of the military. Let's stay healthy. Let's not take that year off. Let's not start that chain of events that begins to occur where you start letting go of a lot of the values that were really positive that we had in the military. Mm-hmm. And that's one of them that we want to try to keep. Plus, it's a great place to network with people and have a social environment, feel like you're part of a community. But the biggest thing that we create is purpose.
Do you have so when someone does get the gym membership, do you have something in place at the gyms, a program to motivate? Because as you're saying, they could be out of the gym for 2 years. I go a week and I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore.
We spent the first hour of the program tonight about talking about what we eat in bed.
Do you have trainers? Do you have something that just, it's going to push them, a program to like, hey.
So as often as we can, we try to also provide a personal training session or two, like a success session with mm-hmm. a personal trainer to help guide the veteran back into fitness. Another few ways that we do this is we partner with other community partners, such as 1 Million Fit. Mark Palmieri's right here in Vernon Hills, guys. Yeah. It's really
Mark's
cool.
Great.
He's working with us, with our organization, to help more veterans get access to the information that they need in order to be successful. And what we also encourage the veterans to do is really become avid users of social media, mm-hmm. because that's where I really learned everything that I learned. And I got pretty fit bodybuilding wise and stuff like that a while back. And now I have kind of made a transfer into functional fitness, Spartan racing and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I've learned everything through social media. There are so many great coaches that you have access to for free right there online.
We talked to Ryan Shannon, who is a veteran. I don't know if you met him.
Oh, I know Ryan very well.
Great guy.
Music RX Foundation.
Yes.
Phenomenal concept.
And what I like about what you do and what Ryan does is that you identify a very tangible thing.
Niche, too.
Yeah, it's niche. It's like, okay, so there's obviously going to be some people that want to work out. There's some people that music is what's going to help them out. Mm-hmm. And then it's tangible. I think when we donate money sometimes to causes and great organizations, it's just kind of thrown into the ether and you hope that they're doing something good with it. When a gym gives you a membership to give away, that is something that we can grab a hold of and we can say, this is 1 year and it represents X amount of dollars. And that's why I imagine why so many people and gyms have rallied around this cause.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the cool thing. Here's the numbers. We've raised $100,000 this year, but we raised $1.6 million worth of gym memberships with $100,000.
Awesome.
And the way that we do that, it really does come down to sales. We contact a gym. We end up getting the front desk service representative.
Right.
very difficult to then get to the GM or the owner because they've been told to protect them from me.
Of course.
So what I do is we find a veteran in the local area and we purchase a gym membership and slide in with a sales pitch during that sales process. And they get really excited when they hear that a nonprofit is purchasing a gym membership for a veteran at their facility to help them transition from military life to civilian life. And it gets them excited about wanting to get involved. And that's typically how we seal the deal with gyms. And that's how we utilize fundraising that people help provide us in order to do that.
So it's just a get in the door free sort of pass.
It is. We can turn one membership into 5 to 22 memberships a year.
Do a lot of gyms sign up for that 22?
We have 141 fitness facilities in the country out of our 289 that donate 22 memberships annually.
Wow, that's incredible. How is it going in Chicago? You want to give any shout outs to some organizations?
Absolutely. Work out anytime in the suburbs. We've got Darien, Wakanda, Naperville, all those work out anytime clubs. They donate 22 memberships a year for veterans. Veterans can apply directly on our website at liftforthe22.org. Export just gave us 12 memberships.
Just
partnered with CrossFit 88 over in Park Ridge. They gave us 5 memberships. CrossFit O'Hare gave us 5 memberships. So I moved out here to Chicago with the specific intent of beginning to grow this market as another big hub for us. And it's starting.
And that's one of the key things we want to say is that, you know, you raise $100,000, that's to get that first membership. But these gyms are, I mean, when they give the membership, I mean, they are giving it, you aren't paying it for the veteran yourselves, or the organization isn't. So it is a big deal for these gyms to do that. I mean, they have bottom lines too that they have to take a look at, and you know, the space requires, you know, what they need. So
there's a cost for every head in the club. There really is. Whether it comes to paper towels or water running or keeping the lights on. Yep.
So the gyms that do partner, we obviously wanted to give them a shout out and things along those lines. Just really recapping for anyone that might be joining us, again, kind of talk through that, like what that feeling of working out means to someone like you, who that was your lifestyle, things changed, you went on a series of events. What does that mean for you?
It's an outlet. That's really what it is. And it's also, it drives a foundation within your life for a sense of purpose. Because when you go into the gym every single day and you pick up the extra 5 pounds that you couldn't pick up the day before, now you go pick up the extra 5 pounds in your life. That mindset changes. When you do that multiple times and you walk into the gym and I was curling 30s yesterday and now I'm curling 35s and next week I'm curling 40s and 45s and
that
I'm working my way up.
That is quick acceleration of those
weights. That's a little quick, but yeah.
I've been on those 35s for so long. And I can do 140 if I really...
We got to work on your form then.
Oh, it's the worst.
But yeah, I mean, that whole mental, like, you got to think about this from a psychological perspective. If I walk into somewhere and I start achieving little goals, that mindset does transfer into everything that you do in life. Mm-hmm. You start going after that degree that you didn't think you could go after the day before because you start achieving those little things and building that self-confidence that's so important.
The first time I put up 225 on the bench, I think I pranced around the streets for like the next 3 days because I was so excited.
I'm with you, actually.
And that was a humble brag, by the way, yes.
My max was 250, so yeah.
I'm at 255 right now, so I'm pretty excited by that.
Very nice.
That's the only workout I actually do. Oh, really quickly, before we let you go, you got a fundraiser coming up this week, right?
Yes, so March 7th, coming up on Wednesday night at Fuse Studios. Studios Fuse here in Chicago. We're going to have our Get Fit, Get Fun event. Studios Fuse has partnered with Lift for the 22 to do a fundraiser. You can find it online, Get Fit, Get Fun on Facebook or on the Eventbrite. It is a ticketed event, $22 per ticket. And we're going to have 3 different workouts that you can choose from. They have the surfboard from Shark Tank that they have an entire studio for. They have the sproing. They have a yoga, a 30-minute yoga class. Mm-hmm. And then we're also going to culminate right after those 3 classes into a team boot camp.
Oh, boy.
I shouldn't have bragged about any of my working out, by the way, because I'm... Carter, you're going to be there on Monday, tomorrow, when I'm coming there for the TV?
With the jam, yeah.
Yes, yeah. I'm going there, and you're going to make me work out, right?
Yeah, let's do the 22 push-up challenge. Why not?
What did you just eat before?
I just ate a bag of Skittles.
Yeah, cool.
Before that.
Good luck.
Wait, what's the 22 push-up challenge? Just doing 22 of them? Or?
Yeah, so why don't... You know what? I'm going to challenge both of you. I want you guys to post it on your social media. You guys
like
have
that.
To do 22 push-ups for 22 days on video.
I like that.
One time a day. Oh, you got to find the time and make it happen to help raise awareness for the cause.
I mean, the first hour of this show was talking about how Esmeralda cooks 4 full meals and brings them into bed.
Although I went to work out today.
You did. No, that's true. And I didn't. So
whatever these muscles by my shoulder... Shoulders are very sore.
Well, I'm heading over to Export here right after this to go hit shoulders. So,
hey, John, can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead, Roger.
All right, so 22 push-ups per day
yes.
for 22 days. Do they have to be 22 in a row, like right at the same time?
Yes.
Can I do one now and come back in an hour?
Can you do five, like,
You're gonna have to do 22 or 22 acts of fitness.
Okay.
Because you could do 22 air squats.
Oh my goodness! Standing up
sore.
Is an act of fitness for me. Jeez.
Oh, Roger, you're already
bringing the coffee mug to your lips.
Well, the Roger brings up a good point. Is a lot of people may not be able to do 22 the first day. The ultimate goal is obviously you build it up and you get as
we want to see people push to that 22 though. You know, if you got to take a pause break for about 30 seconds, but you keep that video running and you hit those 22 and you show everyone that achieving this means something.
This is not an Instagram story then. This is a full video here.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got to really do
it. Even if it takes an hour.
Well, yeah. Instagram Facebook lets you post it in 2 minutes. So try to get them done in 2 minutes.
Oh, boy.
Carter Davis, where can people find out more information?
Liftforthe22.org. Please follow us on Facebook. That tells our story. We do live feed videos of our board meetings, everything. So we would love to show you guys what we are creating for the veteran community within the fitness industry around the nation.
That's great. And I'll see you tomorrow, Carter, okay?
Thanks, guys.
Ask not.
Circuses on the air.
The president doesn't.
Sometimes you feel like a...
That means that it is not illegal.
Sometimes you don't.
Tear down this wall.
Here's Jenning!
Hey, Luke. May the force be with you.
It was you, Kristen, who shot J.R.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
We're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
John's been waiting a long time to take the reins.
My name is Dave Letterman. Last night, I became a father. Thank you very much.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
For the third time in 6 seasons, it's one goal achieved. The Chicago Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup. The Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup.
It's in time. And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series. The Cubs have done it.
And now, this is history.
You're going to need outstanding hosts.
With Dave Plyer.
It's a guy, but I love you.
And Dave Schwann on 720 WGN.
Well, half of that is correct. The other half is not. Dave Schwann is up in the newsroom. Dave Plyer is not done here. Hey, Dave, actually, Plyer was in earlier. He was in for... In the radio theater show.
Yeah, he was in for Carl.
He tossed to us on his show, yes.
Yeah.
So we did
tossed to his own show.
He tossed to his own show and then hit the road.
But he gave us a look like, don't mess up.
We totally messed up. Dave Schwann, before we get to This Is History, the whole first hour we spent talking about eating in bed. Do you eat in bed? Or
no,
are you
never? No,
man.
I don't. I do not. Nor do I watch TV in bed.
Really?
Oh, no. You're good, though.
I do not have a TV in the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I watch TV in the evening, and when I go to bed, I go to bed. That's it. It's as simple as that.
Very healthy.
I don't have a TV in my bedroom, but I bring my iPad into bed, and I watch it. But I watch it with the screen dark. I just listen. I need some white noise in the background or something. I just watch the West Wing. So
I
on repeat over and over again.
It's no joke, Dishwan.
Watching West Wing on demand.
Yeah.
You know what I do on a fairly regular basis, and they say this isn't all that healthy either, is that... if I get something on my mind, like if I'm interested in a good book or something or a magazine, I'll take that in to read before I turn out the lights.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem there is if it's really engaging and interesting and thought-provoking, your mind is going, woo, and then you can't get to sleep.
Yeah, and it's 5 a.m.
And it's 5 a.m. and you're just, what? It's time to get up.
Let's go with some This Is History. Well, that's why we are here. That's what we're here to do. And it's weird to say I love this one and then I'm about to talk about a massacre. But it was the Boston Massacre, which is a fascinating story to tell, and I love the version that they told in the John Adams HBO miniseries, but the Boston Massacre, March 5th, 1770, as many of you know, a group of rowdy Americans harassed British soldiers who then opened fire, killing five and injuring six. A lot of the details of what exactly went down, who said what, was there a rock thrown, was there not, obviously is still left to be, well, probably never figured out at this point, but the first man killed was
Crispus Attucks.
An African-American, and the British captain Thomas Preston and eight of his men were arrested and charged with murder, and it was a trial which took place in October, and John Adams defended the British, and Captain Preston and his six men were acquitted. Two others were found guilty of manslaughter, branded, and then released. But it was just part of the rising tension of what was happening, the brewing nature of what was going on in the 13 colonies.
And you mentioned 1770. That's 6 years before, you know, the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. But there's a place in Boston Boston, there's an actual area there where they mark the exact spot.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
Place. Boston is such a great place to walk around.
That historical area, oh,
everywhere,
my gosh.
Have you been there?
Yes.
Yeah, you know then. You know, everywhere you look. You know, every corner you turn, there's something to see.
Right.
It's amazing.
I got a beer thrown on me at a Bruins game, so that was okay. That was the only part of Boston I didn't like.
I'm kind of I get a little freaked out that they have all those cemeteries. Oh, they're just so cool with just a cemetery in between a couple of buildings.
Yeah.
That was there. The cemeteries were there 200 years before they built the building, so they didn't want to move them.
And Dave, you'd mentioned that 6 years before 1776. Yeah, for people that don't, you know, when we're taught it in history books, it all seems like it happens in a snap. Like
no,
they get there, the colonists are there, they're upset. But I mean, this stuff took years, decades of brooding and building tensions to finally see what we happen with the revolution. Anyways, I guess we're gonna move on.
Yes, moving on.
We could be on that forever.
All right. Well, this one's near and dear to our hearts. 1773 today, Jean Baptiste Pointe du Sable, founded a settlement now known as Chicago.
That's cool. Right over here.
All that far from where we're sitting.
Yes,
that's amazing.
Just down the road, right?
Great?
Right at the river, right?
It's right at the river. The pretty much where there's a statue of him. There's a bust of du Sable. Where apparently that was right there at the Chicago River strategic post, right? Right before you get out to the lake.
Mm-hmm.
So
pay your respects.
And then snaps of African descent.
Yes.
Come on now. Mm-hmm. What?
For sure. And of course, the museum named after him on the south side. Okay. 1849, Abe Lincoln applied for a patent. So he is the only U.S. president to do so. And can anyone guess what it is? Any idea? I don't even know what this means, and I'm reading it. Yeah. It was a device for buoying vessels over shoals.
What are shoals?
I don't know. Dave, any ideas?
Okay. Well, first of all, he actually spent time as a riverboat captain. So,
wow.
I'm thinking shoals are areas in shallow, I guess a shallow spot in the water.
Right.
And if you're buoying something, you're actually floating it over areas that it might be a little too shallow to sail through or to move through. That's a guess, purely a guess.
I'm sure
we're probably going to get a bunch of texts saying,
well, I just looked it up. Shoal is a large number of fish swimming together.
Oh.
Also, in oceanography and earth sciences, a shoal is a natural submerged ridge, bank, or bar.
Okay, so yeah,
we're consists of or is covered by sand.
So shallow. I mean, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, there's a town, and the reason it's famous is because there's been a legendary recording studio there, Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Okay. Okay. I was going to say, that shoal sounds familiar.
That would be, you know, along that area, lower area, around Mobile Bay, near the water.
Okay.
So
we're going to 1868 for the next one,
Esmeralda.
Yes,
March 5th.
All right.
Today.
All right. No, tomorrow, right?
Just so you know. Oh, yeah, that's tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's tomorrow. The U.S. Senate convened as a court to hear charges against President Andrew Johnson during impeachment proceedings. The House of Representatives had already voted to impeach the president. The vote followed bitter opposition by the radical Republicans in Congress to Johnson's Reconstruction policies in the South. However, the effort to remove him failed in the Senate by just one vote, and he remained in office.
Two-thirds majority, Dave, or is it six, three-fifths? I want to say it's a two-thirds for impeachment.
I think it's pretty much two-thirds. It's not a supermajority.
No, I think it's the two-thirds. So it's amazing, though, that 65% of the Senate wanted him out. And it's just amazing to think of the sort of groundswell that would have had to get to that point, and he still doesn't get impeached. So when people talk about these days, not to politicize it about now, people talk, we're going to get President Trump impeached. When you start looking at the political realities of what has to take place for that to happen, it's a pretty tall hurdle, and probably that's a good thing.
And don't forget, we saw this during Bill Clinton's administration. He actually was impeached. What that is an indictment by Congress, the House, and then it goes to the Senate. But on the state level, we saw the whole process with Rod Blagojevich.
Yep. That's right.
Because he was not only impeached by the state representatives, he was convicted unanimously in the Senate, and then he was no longer in office.
Impeachment things are fascinating. I know we're taking so much time on this stuff, but like what I found so fascinating about the Clinton's impeachment to actually see the proceedings go far, because Nixon never got this far. He got through a committee vote, but never got all the way to the full
and
House.
He resigned, and then Gerald Ford pardoned him.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But was that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court oversees the proceedings in the Senate.
That's right.
Rehnquist had to have a designed robe because he didn't want to wear the standard robe. So they had, I remember they mimicked this on SNL. He had the robes with like the gold stripes down it or something. Oh, like that.
Right.
But just think of that they have to go through the archaic documents, you know, of the Constitution. And there it is. The Chief Justice is the one in the Senate that sits there and proceeds over this stuff. And to actually see it play out in a 24-hour news cycle is crazy.
That did not happen in Andrew Johnson's time.
No, that was not. No, not quite. In 1862, we got our first paper money in the United States. Got the 5, the 10, the 20, the 50, the 100, 500, and the $1,000 bill. Two of which, of course, we don't really use anymore. But
I was going to say, have you ever seen a $1,000 bill?
No.
Many years ago.
I work here. Coming. you saw one in person?
Oh, I was a kid, and it was many years ago.
Who was on it?
I don't even remember.
Okay.
I think, Benjamin Franklin, I think, is on the $100 bill.
Right.
I don't remember who was on the $1,000. I don't.
Grover Cleveland, maybe. Let's take a guess there. Oh, you got the poem here,
Esmeralda. Yes, I'm going to just do a little bit because it's very long. Mm-hmm. So, Chicago, this is a poetry written by Carl Sandburg in 1914. So, hog butcher for the world, toolmaker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders.
Big shoulders. And Schwann, stormy, husky, brawling is usually how I introduce you for the news. So.
Well, there's where you get the phrase, big shoulders.
Right, exactly.
From that poem. That is an extraordinary piece of writing.
Yeah, I'm going to skip ahead to 1937. The first blood banks were formed in Chicago. The first true blood bank organized at Chicago's Cook County Hospital. Blood banking began growing in earnest with the return of physicians who had seen the effectiveness of the transfusion therapy on the front lines of World War II. And they began to demand that blood be made available for treatment of their patients. I had no idea that blood bank history has its roots here in the city.
Very nice.
Dave, you know that?
No, you just learned everything here on this program. I didn't know that.
Well, we're going to keep on learning more. Yeah. We've got to take a quick commercial break and more. This is History with Dave Schwann coming up on 720 WGN.
I'm telling him.
You said nothing yet. Go ahead and tell me.
Who's on first? What's on second? I don't know. Is on third.
You know the guy's name's on the baseball team?
Yes.
Well, go ahead. Who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the guy's name.
Who?
The guy playing first.
Who?
The guy playing first base.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
What are you asking me for? I don't know.
Now, wait a minute. I'm
asking you who's on first.
That's his name.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first.
That's it. That's his name.
Well, you ain't said nothing. I ain't asked you nothing.
You did.
You know the guy's name on first base?
Sure.
Well, tell me the guy's name on first base.
Who?
The guy playing first base.
Who is on first, Lou?
What are you asking me for?
Don't get excited. I'm saying who.
I'm asking you a simple question. Who's on first?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
That's it.
That's who? Yeah. I'm asking you, what's the guy's name on first base?
Oh, no. What's on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
One base at a time.
I could listen to that entire thing and laugh.
I
it
love
has stood
that.
The history of time. Yes, it was who on first. And Esmeralda, what's a little history behind that?
1944 is Abbott and Costello's baseball routine. I like it so. Oh, never mind. I thought that was the name of it. I was like, well, that's very generic of it. Also known as Who's on First. 1944 was when they copyrighted it.
That's amazing. You know, it's so funny as you listen to old bits and sketches from shows maybe before your time, and they don't stand the test. You don't maybe laugh out loud at that.
Yeah.
I could listen to that sketch any year, any time, and I say the same thing. Yeah. Anyone, any age will laugh at that, Dave Schwann.
That's right.
And I do remember they did a play on this on, did you ever watch Tiny Toons?
No.
Well, remember Tiny Toons
with the
cartoon? They did that, but it was a whole thing about the Who with Woodstock.
Oh, interesting.
But it was the whole thing, because they're like, who's playing on that stage? Like, yes.
Right.
Yes is on the second stage. It was a whole thing. Yeah.
On Tiny Toons.
That's
yes.
Funny.
I don't remember Tiny Toons, a cartoon for little kids.
That would have been cute.
Dave, do you know the whole lineup or no?
No, who's on first? I don't know who's on second. Anybody's on third?
What's on
like
second?
That.
I don't know who's on third.
There
left field has why.
Yeah.
Center field is because. Pitching the battery is tomorrow throwing to today as your catcher. And at shortstop, it's I don't give a darn.
There is one other quick classic routine, a Jack Benny one, that is nowhere near as long as the Abbott and Costello one, where he's walking down a street and you hear it's on radio and you hear him walking down the street, you know, footsteps, and then all of a sudden a guy comes up to him, a robber, and says, your money or your life. And there's a pause.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, I'm thinking about it. Because Jack Benny was always hoarding money.
Yes. So. 1960, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. And I'm kind of surprised by this. I knew that we had a second football team.
Oh.
I knew that they were the Cardinals. I know that they had moved at some point west and eventually getting all the way to Arizona. But Dave Schwann, I didn't realize that that didn't happen. Their move to St. Louis first until 1960.
But that's about right. Yeah, 1960.
So I'm not trying to date you, Dave. I don't know where
I was four.
Okay, so you don't remember the Chicago.
I'll ask my dad. He was a diehard
Cardinals fan.
My dad was born in 1950, so he probably would remember at least coverage of the Cardinals as a kid.
Something, or seeing it in the paper or on TV, sure.
I just always assumed that that was something that they had moved in the 20s or the 30s.
I knew they were here in the 40s because I knew an older gentleman that was at a Chicago Cardinals game and came out of the game at the end. It happened to be December 7th, 1941.
Wow.
And there were extra editions of newspapers outside there. How about that?
That is crazy. Yeah, of course, we're talking about Pearl Harbor if you didn't get that thing. But yeah, that was a Sunday, so that makes sense. Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, so 1981, Walter Cronkite steps down from CBS Evening
News. That I do remember.
Dude, were you watching?
Yes, I was.
Well, that was big stuff then, those nightly news programs. Everyone, of course, watched those. And that was a big
one. The hoopla that led up to that
was it big?
From all the networks, not just CBS. You had full-page ads from NBC and ABC congratulating him and commending him on his accomplishments. It was awesome. It was unbelievable.
Well, I'm amazed that apparently CBS had a mandatory retirement age
of
65.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you imagine that now?
No, not now.
Is that why? Is that when he
pretty
stepped down
so.
When he was 65?
Yeah, pretty much.
They couldn't lift that for Walter Cronkite?
He was far and away still leading the charge as number one on a nightly newscast
at
that time.
And I do love this. His last day in the anchor chair at the CBS Evening News was on March 6, 1981. He was succeeded the following Monday by Dan Rather.
Yep.
Wow.
That's right.
I believe we have some audio for that, too.
This is my last broadcast as the anchorman of the CBS Evening News. For me, it's a moment for which I long have planned, but which nevertheless comes with some sadness. For almost two decades, after all, we've been meeting like this in the evenings, and I'll miss that. But those who have made anything of this departure, I'm afraid, have made too much. This is but a transition, a passing of the baton. A great broadcaster and gentleman, Doug Edwards, preceded me in this job, and another, Dan Rather, will follow. And anyway, the person who sits here is but the most conspicuous member of a superb team of journalists, writers, reporters, editors, producers, and none of that will change. Furthermore, I'm not even going away. I'll be back from time to time with special news reports and documentaries, and beginning in June, every week with our science program, Universe. Old anchormen, you see, don't fade away. They just keep coming back for more. And that's the way it is. Friday, March 6th, 1981. I'll be away on assignment, and Dan Rather will be sitting in here for the next few years. Good night.
No, the Cody MacArthur and such like that.
That was his always his last line. And that's the way it is. He would say that at the end of every newscast.
That's incredible. And then Dan Rather, of course, went for a long time until his departure under strange circumstances after some reports and all the things like that. But even Dan Rather is still doing stuff, a lot of stuff on social media.
See him on CNN from time to time.
CNN, exactly.
Yeah, everything he writes I see in social media, I'm just like, wow, so spot on.
Man, those evening news, so Cronkite's before me, but for me it was Peter Jennings at ABC.
Oh, sure.
And he was just, that's the reason I got into news.
Peter Jennings?
Some form of, I love Peter Jennings. And when not only how Peter would cover the world news and on the evening roundups, but any breaking news. I think one of the iconic things is September 11th, how many people went to Peter Jennings.
Yeah.
And he was at that anchor chair for 20 hours. And I actually, it's strange to say, but just being fascinated with news, I have old VHS tapes, actually. I went home, I ditched school for the rest of the day, put in a VHS tape on 9/11, hit record and recorded about 9 hours of footage from that day. And every now and then I will find a way, or it's on YouTube as well, to watch it just to see how amazing and with such poise he was able to handle that situation. Because unless you sit in that chair when that stuff's happening, I can't even fathom going through that. When no one has any real information about what's happening, the way he was able to take information, give it to the masses, but not cause mass hysteria, to just give you the facts while there were rumors swirling everywhere, it was really incredible. I imagine Cronkite would have been very similar in that chair as well.
Yeah. Well, he was. Think back. He was there when John Kennedy was assassinated. Mm-hmm. And people were saying he was crying on the air. It wasn't really a breakdown on the air, but he definitely was choked up when the fact of it was that things were official, that the president was dead.
Right.
So he choked up for a bit, but collected himself immediately.
Right. You know, watching those events as they happen live is always very fascinating. The last one we're going to mention, 1996, 21 years ago this week, comedian George Burns died at age 100 years old. We have a little clip from Ron Letterman.
Now, have you always smoked a cigar?
Yeah, I use it. You know, when I was 14, I smoked my first cigar. I wanted to look like an actor. I bought a Recorder cigar, 7 cents. Lasted a week.
Yeah, and it helps. It's good timing and a good prop.
Oh yeah, I walk on the stage. I smoke a cigar, and the people laugh. I smoke.
Yeah.
When they stop laughing, I talk.
Yeah.
If I talk while they're laughing, I should be put away.
Now I noticed that you have an engagement in 1996.
Right. The Palladium Theater.
The Palladium in
London. I'll be 100 years older. I'm there for 4 weeks.
George Burns, age 100, dies 21 years ago this week in 1996. Dave, thanks for playing along again.
This is always fun. Good to be with you folks again.
It's a blast. All right, always fun as well. All right, that'll wrap things up for us. Esmeralda, you're going home. Are you going to go in bed? What are you going to bring to eat?
I'm actually going to go get breakfast.
Oh, in bed?
Yeah. I'm going to open up a restaurant where you eat in bed.
Oh, my God. You just get a bunch of mattresses.
Oh,
and I've got the perfect name for it. Breakfast in bed.
Oh, that was easy. Come on, Shawnee. There you go.
Do you want to put some money into this? We'll be partners.
$1.98 I have in my pocket?
Oh, I'll go that as well. Okay, this is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com.